And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 27th of September 2024, streaming live from East Owen Studios, hopefully sounding a little bit better than we were the last couple of weeks. And we're in Bristol, back in Bristol, which with London's Inner Temple is one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora and not Google Play. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, and, no, they're not fired, hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III, Tampon Charlie, or wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, prisons, cost of living, climate, a new one every few months. The twisted Armageddonists' accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. God, they're getting good at this, aren't they? And amazing that we still fall for it. Some of us do. Sorry, thousands of journalists do, apparently. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's behaviourist, Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to the AI. Albert Pike's World War III is relying on your blind obedience, folks. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. Gosh, they're going down, folks. They're their latest glove puppet, that is to say, panda-eyed energy saboteur Secretary Ed Miliband. Nothing from him this week, I hope. But anyway, it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So, helping us navigate the Fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also Matt O'Brannan, who's a New Zealand, or Kiwi, should we say, I suppose, activist here in Bristol. Both welcome to the programme.
G'day.
Hi.
So I suppose we should start with you, really, Matt, because the reason it will pique my interest is to invite you to come back, and you're very, very thankfully agreed, was this event at the Cube Cinema here in Bristol, which is supposed to be an alternative cinema. Now, I've had dealings with him over the years. All sorts of interesting events took place. And we maybe could start, Martin, if you could just explain a bit about I think it was in 2006, we held a special evening there, the premiere of a film called Mind the Gap, which we brought a whole load of people from all over the city together to talk about the 7/7 London bombings and premiering a film which our friend Adrian Connor had just produced. Sadly, though, using David Chaler, former MI5 officer, as a voiceover, because he then came out as Jesus and a transvestite and lost all of his credibility, really. But anyway, that event was quite good, wasn't it?
Well, it was obviously fairly well attended, and we actually had it on the anniversary of the attack, if you remember.
7th of July.
So it was the 7th of July.
2006,
that's right. And obviously, they'd had to work quite hard to get the film into the shape that it could be used for that event. And as you say, the voiceover for the film, it was about a half-hour film called Mind the Gap, was David Chaler. And and of course he was an ex-MI5 officer, which is why we used him.
He was a whistleblower, to be fair.
Well, he was a whistleblower. He was an MI5 officer, but he and his colleague, Annie Machon, discovered through their work that MI6 were plotting to kill Colonel Gaddafi, which they're not supposed to do. It's outside of their remit.
And that would be presumably through chatting to friends at MI6.
Well, what happened, I spoke to Dave Scheller about it afterwards. He said he was sitting in his office at MI5, because he and Annie were the Libya desk, so they were dealing with Libya. And the Libya desk, or the Libya people from MI6, came to see them, and they told them that they were going to use the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group in order to assassinate Gaddafi, and that they had a plot where they'd try and bomb him. And they discussed all of this quite openly, and at the time, Dave Shaler said to me, I thought they were joking. I just thought they were just coming out with a load of rubbish. But then, of course, I read in the newspapers the following week that in actual fact this bombing attack had taken place. It hadn't killed Gaddafi. It had killed various random people around Gaddafi, but it hadn't killed him. And at that point, he and Annie decided that they would then approach the then Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, to tell him what had happened and say, look, this is our people doing this. And of course, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group were based in Manchester, because that's where MI6 had placed them, because they were opposed to Gaddafi, and they were allowed to operate in this country because they were anti-Gaddafi. But of course, many of them had fought in Afghanistan for Al-Qaeda. A lot of Libyans from Tripoli, in particular, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, strong in Tripoli. They'd fought in Afghanistan for Al-Qaeda. They couldn't go back to Libya because they were wanted in Libya. And so they all ended up living in Manchester. And that, of course, is where the guy who blew up the Manchester arena,
Salman Abedi.
Yeah, he was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group.
As if he did.
The guy who was accused of it or whatever. But he had been in Libya fighting Gaddafi, had come back to Manchester, and had then blown up the arena.
Now, there was a bit of an altercation between you and David Shaler at the
queue. Well, no, most people don't know about that, so I don't particularly
want to talk about it?
No, because we got the BBC. If you remember, we'd been negotiating the BBC about being in
their conspiracy files. We were actually in their programme, weren't we?
Yeah, so in other words, the BBC were inside the cube filming the event, yeah?
For a BBC documentary,
which we were then in, as you know, because they'd picked up on our
part of the conspiracy.
They'd picked up on our film on the internet. They'd approached us because they were making a film about conspiracy theorists, and they were fairly honest with us. They said, you know, this is about you, not about the theory. But you and I agreed that we were willing to cooperate with making the film.
Yeah, we toughed it out, didn't we?
We were willing to make the film because it would get the allegations we'd made in the original film out there. And they did a pretty good job of going through the allegations.
So what was the problem with Mr. Shaler being there then?
Well, he turned up, off his head, no shoes on. And I thought, we don't really need him wandering in. The BBC would have loved it. Mm-hmm. They would have loved it. But yeah. I made sure that he didn't come into the... I'd done my bit, and I went to the bar, and I went outside with my bottle of beer, and then Shaler and another fella turned up, and I said, you can't go in there, we've got the BBC in there. I said, we want to talk to the BBC. You're not talking to the BBC.
You're not talking to the BBC.
Yeah. No shirt, no shoes, no BBC.
Yeah, that's right.
That's censorship, Martin.
Well, it's because by that stage, when we'd originally used him, or Adrian had used him as a voiceover for the film, there was a script which was written for him, and he just had to stick to it. Yeah, so he didn't write the script; we wrote the script, or Adrian wrote the script. And B, at that stage, he was still a whistleblowing MI5, ex-MI5 officer. He hadn't decided that he was Jesus, and he hadn't decided to transition to being a female.
In a way, it doesn't really matter so much about those things, but he came out as an adamant exponent of the no planes theory.
Well, that's
this idea there were no planes. This is exactly what the BBC wanted to film.
That's right.
People going, oh, there were no planes on 9/11. That was all an illusion.
Well, and I was in, but you, if you remember, Tony, you had set him up to be interviewed by the New Statesman.
I did, yeah.
That's
and
a stretch.
I was up in London when the New Statesman came round to Belinda's house to interview him. And we sat him down, me, Annie, Belinda, and various other people said, you are not to say anything out of order.
And guess
just
what?
Just stick to the
guess
script.
What? Guess
stick
what?
To the script. And we were all listening through the, you know, listening through the wall while he was being interviewed by the New Statesman. And the first thing he came, well, the first thing I'd like to say, there were no planes. And we'd just been saying to him, don't say that. Oh, and of course, the New Statesman had the no planes nutters as their headline. Yeah. Now you can see why.
Actually, the headline, if people want to look it up, was Meet the No Planers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
anyway,
in other words, that wasn't very helpful.
So this is the cube. This is the context of the cube. The cube has done some really good things.
Yes, I mean, we also did much better. Before that, we'd done 9/11 events there where we'd tried to, you know, we'd tried to raise the questions about 9/11, which had happened previously. But this was our film that we'd made ourselves rather than using other people's material. So it was quite important, and you know, in the end, it worked quite well. I think what happened when the Conspiracy Files film went out, I mean, they did indeed try to make out that we were nutters.
Well, not so much. So we were trying to make out we were dangerous and talking to the Muslims.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, these two lads from Bristol went up to Birmingham Central Mosque to talk to the Muslims.
Yes, that's right. So in other words, what we negotiated with Tristram Quinn, who was the producer, was, don't make us look stupid, make us look dangerous, which is pretty much what he did.
And, you know, it's like Trump goes to speak to China and Russia, and that means he's dangerous because he allies with these demagogues.
Yes.
Biden tries to wage war with them and bring us into World War III, and he's a saviour of democracy. And,
that's right. You know, anyway, but all of these things are about how, you know, the media works. And
well, actually, to be fair to Tristan, he'd been an ex-Panorama guy. And, I mean, I'm always, you know, I like to see a bit of good in the BBC. We showed him the Gladio films, didn't we?
Never
seen.
That's right.
From 1993, yeah. From Time Watch. And he sat through, and he was so slightly changed. He looked like he'd been frozen, in the headlights a little bit by that. And he was a slightly changed person when he came back. Oh yes, those Gladio, that
that's
Gladio
right.
Film.
I mean, what he said was, how did he get those interviews? Because of course, Frankovich, who made the film, had interviewed the head of SISMIC, the Italian secret services. And the guy said, well, of course we did all of that.
Yeah.
We blew everything up. We killed everybody.
It was a wake up call a bit for Tristan to know that NATO intelligence services had actually been blowing people up all across Europe and trying to blame it on, well, they did it successfully blame it on, often on the Soviet Union. And,
well, also on the left, on the left
supporters,
etc. In other words, the Red Brigades were.
Anyway, let's shut up and let's hear from Matt. Let's hear from Matt now about this year's event at, because you turned up, didn't you? It was an event to do with 9/11 conspiracies or what was it about? What was it? How was it titled?
Yeah, it was called the Truth Seekers Ball, and
wear kind of going out clothes and sort of bib and tucker or what?
I wore my best Gitmo chic, which of course I wore for 2 years.
Your orange suit.
And that's right. I decided to bring it out and change the sign from Free Assange to Pardon Assange, because that's the next step, and we'll have more on that later. But yeah, good chance to dust that off and spark some good conversations, actually, with people there, of course, which is why I always wore that. And and it was nice to see a lot of people that, you know, aware of it and cared about it. The event itself, it was quite, they were quite openly open about the fact that this was a, well, they said that we invite you to bring a presentation. It's quite a nice format. You can bring a USB stick and some slides and talk about anything you want. And they did say, you know, it can be silly or it can be serious. So I thought, well, I'll go along and I'll talk about the Assange case because it's a good opportunity and it's still fresh. But when I got there at the, it seemed that the general consensus among everyone attending was that we were going to be silly. So, I mean, look, I'm not going to fault them or blame them for that. It was actually hilarious. I was thoroughly entertained. They handed out tinfoil so everyone could make their own tinfoil hats. Someone did I just decided I was going to bury my story willingly because I just didn't want to go up there and change the mood. And so, yeah.
So were we talking about things like Flat Earth and this sort of thing?
No, they actually, people had some very creative things. Like one presentation I particularly liked was one about how, you know, why are printers, in this day and age when we, you know, all sorts of technological advances, why do printers still not function properly? Why do they always break? Why is always something wrong with it? The tone is out, this is that wrong. And this person made the very compelling case, tracing all the way back to, you know, the printing press, and who was not a fan of the printing press? The church, because they wanted to, you know, certain members of the church wanted to hold on to the narrative. They didn't want it translated into English. They didn't want the public to get their hands on all of it and be able to read it for themselves, because they wanted to, you know, dish out the bits that suited the political narrative at the time. Anyhow, so that was their argument, and they sort of linked it all up and said, well, we believe that now the church is actually putting out Trojan viruses as system updates, printer updates, that will cause your printer not to completely fail, but just to be slightly just to sort of slow, try to stem the tide of the free, the independent sort of public free press, as you will.
So the church is behind this. Wow.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's no suppression of Christianity going on, or any other kind of moral, Abrahamic faith or anything like that, like Messianic Judaism or the Naturi Carta or anything like that. So this is, this is quite a typical cube. They're quite tricksy like that. Anyway, so what did you end up not doing a presentation, even though you've got your suit on there, your orange suit?
Know.
A fancy dress actually sounds like a great idea for something like that.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I would encourage people to go again and maybe bring some serious topics. I think there was one in the end. I'm trying to remember that there was one person that did something.
Well, this is the thing: serious. Is the flat earthers might turn up with a very serious, you know, say this is a serious thing.
Yeah, I think
some of them take
great.
It incredibly seriously. And get quite nasty if you suggest that maybe the Earth is actually a sphere.
Yeah. There could be some tension. That's what I felt, because there was such a lively audience participation. Like it became like a Punch and Judy show, and the crowd was jeering and cheering, and there were these running jokes about how for some reason France was to blame for everything. Is that a common theme here in England? I don't know. It just somehow came about.
100 Years War, I think.
Fair enough, I think.
So I was tempted.
The raids all along our coast over hundreds of years, I think, have sort of Gwyneth Paltrow.
And Gwyneth Paltrow became linked to all sorts of theories as well.
Who is Gwyneth Paltrow?
Oh, the actress. What's she been in? You'd know, Martin, what's she?
No, I don't know. Only thing I know about her is that she was at one time the squeeze for the boy from Oasis, whatever his name is, Liam.
There you go.
Noel Gallagher.
I knew you'd know all the celebrity goss.
Yeah.
I haven't been a huge fan of her. She was in something I liked, but that was the exception. But I tried to find a way to tie that into, and then think, could I still do something very serious on Julian Assange and try to scare these people into understanding how significant it is and tie in these things? So my plan was to do my presentation and then zoom into a photograph of the Belmarsh prison where he was held, which I noted had has a French motto on the coat of arms. I'm probably butcher if I can try to recall it. Mon droit, my God and my right.
Dieu et mon droit.
God
and my right.
Yeah.
In French, of course, because it was a French ruling class that came over with the Normans.
Right on. There you go.
That's why we hate them.
They are all behind it all there. So, I mean, yeah, it was a fun night, but it's, you could certainly, it would be interesting to bring in some more serious theories as well.
I think, it's good that they've had a balance between the two, because it sort of leaves room for almost everything, which is good to see the Cube doing that. But Martin, this whole idea of sort of ridiculing conspiracy theory has become massive, hasn't it, really? It's something that goes on massively in the mainstream press as well. A conspiracy theorist is a nutter. Actually, of course, the mainstream press is a conspiracy theorist by saying things like, we can end this war by eliminating Hamas, for example. This is a complete and utter nonsense. Yep. It's a conspiracy theory, and yet it's trotted out time and time again.
Well, the term conspiracy theory was actually originally invented by the CIA, because after the assassination of JFK, various people were questioning the Warren Commission's report and everything that had been said about it, and the way it was being talked about in the media and in, you know, in the pub or wherever, was as theories of the assassination. And the CIA really didn't like this, because of course if people are going to use a serious
sort of leading back to the CIA,
it keeps leading back it keeps leading back to the assassination. So what they we've got the documents, the internal documents from the CIA, and they instructed their operatives and the people that they controlled in the media to start calling people who questioned the official story conspiracy theorists. And this was then going to be used as, and it's been used subsequently ever since. Anybody who questions the official account of any event is a conspiracy theorist. We all know, for example, that it was, that whatever happened in the way that the government said it happened, and anybody who says different is a conspiracy theorist. And of course they're very good at this kind of, it's psychological warfare. Yeah, you frame the narrative by framing the language in which people can talk about these things,
and then of course
you can then control how people perceive the various things.
There's been a lot of this
on.
Going on at the UN actually this week, the UN General Assembly, with Starmer, for example, accusing the Russians of being the, you know, sort of trying to start World War III. The idea, it seems, is to ridicule those who are trying to make peace, and literally to justify those who aren't trying to make peace. Anyway, any thoughts about the sort of 9/11 stuff generally? I mean, since that was supposedly the date for this event at the Cube, Matt.
Yes, that's right. It was held on 9/11. I mean, God, there's a wide array of thoughts and theories. I'm always, I err on the side of, look, I'm not gonna put my foot in to anything until I see concrete evidence. And I tend to believe in Occam's razor as well. If you have, in the absence of evidence, you go with the simplest option. It's probably most likely, but there's certainly still a lot of extremely fishy things, and that are quite well documented, around how the US intelligence lost track of the operatives they knew were coming in. Then investigations were shut down twice. Why was that? Now, some people might say that's because, well, does that indicate the US was involved? Not necessarily, because the other potential thing they're trying to avoid is embarrassment that they traced these operatives, they knew about the attack, and then they lost track of them. I mean, that is a monumental blunder that you can see why they wouldn't want to confess to. And I tend to fall on thinking that it was Al-Qaeda, but perhaps there was more knowledge by certain intelligence agencies, not just the US. There seems to be evidence that maybe other nations like Israel might have had some knowledge of the attacks, there was this classic very interesting story. I don't know if your listeners are aware of the dancing Israelis.
Oh, so is this what you were going to be putting forward at the Cube? You were going to talk about
the
dancing Israelis?
No, but I it's just something that came up.
It's one of those amazing,
and
of course the dancing Israelis sounds so great, doesn't it? Who were they?
It was a group of, I think it was four Israelis that were spotted in New Jersey by a few witnesses to be celebrating and dancing and high-fiving each other and taking photographs and video of the attacks, of the planes flying into the buildings. And so-called the dancing Israelis, because they were seen to be celebrating. And
so they would just happen to be there.
Yeah, well, that's the question, isn't it? And so it becomes very curious when there's actually a TV clip you can find on YouTube of these guys being interviewed on Israeli television after this fact, because they were picked up and they were arrested. They were detained for some time. They were eventually sent back sent back to Israel. But they were interviewed on television, and the presenter asked them why they were there, and one of them answered, "We were there to document the event."
A surprise attack. That's pretty clever. Isn't
they it? Also admitted to being Mossad agents.
Yeah, I've heard this was. Yeah. Did they admit to that?
Yeah, they did.
I've heard there was links.
They're not just random tourists.
Isn't it funny? Yeah. Because we've got the anniversary coming up of October the 7th. Is it next week or the week after?
Mm.
The BBC have put together a documentary, and sent you this earlier on. Jonathan Cook, our very own Bristol-based ex-Guardian journalist, has uploaded an article this week. Israelis will dance again. Vows the BBC film. Will Gaza's children ever get to dance? He says. Gaza's children have no voice. Their tears evaporate in the summer heat and merge with the winter rain. No one comes to make a documentary about them. No one comes at all. He says, much about the institutional racism of the BBC that it thinks surviving October the 7th, We Will Dance Again, is a suitable title for its documentary marking the first anniversary of the massacre of Israelis at the Nova Rave. Presumably, the programme makers believed it suggested healing and empowerment for those who survived October the 7th, rather than, as it does, continuing indifference to the horrifying plight of the people of Gaza who live, or in so many cases have died, just a stone's throw from where the Nova Festival was held. At the time of the rave, Palestinians were trapped in the concentration camp of Gaza under a medieval-style siege by land, sea and air that Israel had imposed on them for 17 years, until, that is, Hamas broke out for one day on October the 7th, briefly spreading carnage in its wake. So this is an interesting title to use, isn't it, for the BBC, Martin, for this documentary, actually calling it Surviving October the 7th, We Will Dance Again.
Yes, well, and if you remember, there were two Israeli bloggers who were going on about how great it was to go to parties and dance when you knew that the people in Gaza were starving, which came out a couple of weeks ago. And those guys used to be PR people for Netanyahu, so they're not just random people.
Two Nice Jewish Boys.
Is the name of the podcast. Also, of course, what actually happened on October the 7th is just like 9/11. There were suspicious stock trades the week before in Tel Aviv of people who must have had foreknowledge, because they sold the right stocks and they bought the right stocks to make a killing, literally. Mm. And of course, that's exactly what happened on 9/11. It was clear that somebody knew what was happening, because they'd bought military stocks and sold the stocks of the airlines, which were in the planes that were used. That meant they had foreknowledge. Now, they then investigated it to say that implies somebody had foreknowledge. That means they must have been involved. And of course, they investigated it. And the person who carried out those original stock trades was a guy called Buzzy Krongard, who was in fact former executive. Yep. Well, it was called Buzzy, but I think he's got another name. And he, of course, was former executive director of the CIA. So at that point, they stopped investigating and said, well, he's got nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, so therefore there must be nothing in this.
They called him Buzzy because wherever he went into the room, if there was a radio on, it would start buzzing.
Yes. Well, I mean, the point is, both of these attacks had devices on him of some sort. The Nova Rave, and as you know, raves get moved around, yeah? Because they're going to be doing illegal drugs or whatever. So they were, in fact, supposed to be having the rave quite a long way away from Gaza. And then just before the attack, everybody's phoned up. It's all been moved to the place where they were. So they were in just the right place for the Hamas operatives, as they came out of Gaza, to run into them. And they were surprised. They were going to attack the military facilities around Gaza, because it's surrounded by military bases. But they didn't expect to run into a rave. And, of course, a lot of the people at the rave did die, but they were killed by the Israeli armed forces, who just decided to kill everybody in order to... What they were told, because they have what's called the Hannibal Doctrine, that we do not want Hamas to have hostages, because they can, you know... And when Gilad Shalit was captured, Israeli soldier was captured many years before, they held him for a long time, and they were able to exchange him for 1,000 prisoners. Mm. So each of those potential hostages, and don't forget, all adults in Israel serve in the army, so all of them are definitely fair game from a military point of view. If you're over 18, you're fair game, male or female.
Well, I don't agree with that. I don't think it's fair game. A lot of them go into do a sort of alternative civilian type thing.
Well, no, you can't.
Yes, they do.
No, you can't. In actual fact, you get punished if you try and do that. And of course, the kibbutzes themselves have arms. You know, they're armed. Yeah. The people have had military training, and some of them did fight back when Hamas tried to break in. So, of course, all adults in Israel, apart from the very religious Jews, serve in the army. And therefore, they're all fair game. They can be killed or they can be captured. That's warfare.
Well, now, it isn't, is it? I mean, it's completely different between armed forces and civilians. There's a massive difference.
If you are in the Israeli army, you're a reservist.
Maybe you are. I mean, you might be called up and you might say no.
No, so that doesn't make someone a target, does it? Well, I think...
You're exaggerating.
Let's put it this way. The Israelis have been bombing Lebanon this week. They've killed hundreds of people. I suggest to you that a tiny, tiny fraction of those people would have been armed Hezbollah.
It's about 700, isn't it?
Yeah, and most of those people are just people. Loads of children have been killed.
I mean, if you really want to get into this, this is not the Israeli population getting involved, civilians getting mobilised to do this, is it? Because they don't actually really want to send soldiers into Lebanon. They'd much rather use American money and American weapons and lob them in and kill as many Lebanese without actually risking any Israeli lives. They don't really want to invade. Well, they'd much rather do it with American money and American munitions.
That's right, but I mean, we'll see what happens, because it's obviously, you know, it's still an ongoing thing.
No, that's right. And it does come back to the Israel is dancing, the Nova Festival. It's highly suspicious that that festival was shifted there at the last moment. And there were some Israeli occupation force officials saying, like, this shouldn't happen. And then some higher ups said, nah, we're pushing this, we're approving this festival to be there. As well as other bits of evidence about, you know, there were reports that the attack was going to happen. The people in the kibbutzes were saying, hey, we've seen these training exercises happening that look quite strange and it's increasing. And yeah, so it just, like, to me, the dance festival is just too perfect. It's so scripted, as if, you know, to prepare this narrative that these young, innocent, beautiful, free people have just, this is obviously a cynical view, but might be realistic. And obviously it's tragic, any loss of life. And I have no, you know, non-violent advocacy, not for violence, but, you know, that just, if you were to set up some sort of what do you call it? It's not exactly a false flag, but when you allow this sort of a thing, if you allow
lie
this
hop,
sort of thing,
let it happen on purpose.
Let it happen.
Lie hop.
As opposed to my hop made it happen
let
on purpose.
Let it happen. Great. Yeah. So yeah, let it happen on purpose. I mean, to justify it, certainly would fit with a lot of the things we've heard Israeli officials say, such as this is great. This is just like our 9/11. It just seems perfectly scripted to have a music festival like that to be disrupted by such carnage and violence, which, as you say, is also being proven that Israel is responsible for a lot of the deaths. Exactly what percentage would be very interesting to know, but certainly a lot.
I wonder, are both of you this, what you think, how you think 9/11 fits into what we're seeing today in Gaza, and maybe, you know, some things in between, but it seems to me that it sort of set the stage for the 21st century. And of course, we've got this rather nasty little organisation called the Project for the New American Century, which I would rather had never have been thought about or existed at all, really. And we could have had a kind of normal century, perhaps. But Martin, how is this, what stage along the road to where we are now was 9/11?
Well, when 9/11 happened, Ehud Barak, I believe, was in... Netanyahu was asked, was it good or bad? Oh, it's good, he said. And of course, the dancing Israelis, when they were interviewed by the police, they said, we're not your problem. Your problem is the Palestinians. They're the real enemy. That's what they said. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, people in Palestine are very well aware of all these things. They do, you know, they have social media. They follow all this stuff. And there's very strong evidence that the Israelis were involved in 9/11, not least because they had foreknowledge. They clearly had foreknowledge, because the guys who were videoing it, they videoed the first plane crashing into the first building. Mm. They were in exactly the right spot. And of course, it was reported in the Bergen Record, which is a local newspaper in New York. But of course, in this day and age, that is enough. Yeah, it's on the record. And of course, it's something that can be looked at on the internet, and there was no way that they could hide it. Now, there's lots of other evidence as well. I mean, as you know, we've covered 9/11 exhaustively over the years.
You talking about Benjamin Netanyahu's words on 9/11, Electronic Intifada got a nice little article where they say, it's very good, recalling Benjamin Netanyahu's words on the day of the 9/11 attacks. It's very good. So the way they explain that, he says, asked tonight what the attack meant in relations between the United States and Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, former Prime Minister, replied, it's very good. He predicted the attack would strengthen the bond between our two peoples because we've experienced terror over so many decades. The United States has now experienced a massive hemorrhaging of terror, and it will generate immediate sympathy. So that was Netanyahu back on 9/11. I mean, to say 9/11 is very good, it's strange, isn't it? But most people wouldn't have even connected it with Israel maybe at the time.
Well, no, and of course, obviously, I realised immediately there's something wrong with it, but I didn't want to start accusing the Israelis, because obviously you then get accused of anti-Semitism, blah and blah, so you've got to be very careful before you start talking about that. But when it came out about the dancing Israelis, and also various other things which pointed in the finger towards the Israelis. Then at that
what?
Point,
what other things?
I'm trying to remember the thing. There was a thing. I'm trying to remember when General Mahmoud Ahmad had been talking because he was in the ISI in Pakistan. So I haven't got any notes in front of me,
no,
Tony.
I know.
And of course, right. there's a lot of detail involved in all
well,
of this.
Well, anyone that wants to look at that particular point, I mean,
there's a very good article about it on
Wiki Spooks. Wookie Spooks.
By a guy called Wyatt. I don't know this first name.
Well, if you go to Wiki Spooks, you'll find an article, 9/11, Israel did it, all the proof in the world.
Yeah, that's...
And this is the one that Stephen Sizer, the vicar in London, shared, and he was banned from... He was told by the Archbishop of Canterbury, you're not allowed to talk about the Middle East in any of your sermons.
Yeah, well, anymore. I mean, I think the point about this is that even if the Israelis were involved, and I think the evidence suggests they were, they didn't do it on their own. Elements within the US military and intelligence services were clearly
complicit. And names keep popping up of people who were joint US-Israeli citizens as well, don't they?
That's right. Well, I mean, Chertoff, who is the head of Homeland Security, is a joint Israeli-American citizen. So are most of the people who wrote the PNAC document. Yeah.
New American Century. Yeah, anyway, folks, we are rebelling against this new American Century right now.
Do you take Osama bin Laden's, audio confession to be? Do you think he was still involved?
Well, no.
Good question.
As far as I know, Osama bin Laden issued a statement saying that he wasn't involved. But of course, anybody can issue a statement saying there is Osama bin Laden saying that he admitted he was involved.
As far as I know, he was dead. He had a kidney operation.
That's right. He'd had
Dubai.
One of the first things I noticed was that in The Guardian, there was an article by, I've forgotten whose name now, because again, you can't remember everything, but it was an article in The Guardian that said that the French secret services had said, off the record, that the CIA had gone to meet with bin Laden in the American hospital in Dubai, where he was having a kidney operation. And they went to meet him and gave him, a get-well card and some flowers.
An explosive get-well card?
Well, because he was on their payroll and had been, on their payroll for years. He was on their payroll from the very beginning. Yeah. You know, the CIA and MI6 decided they were going to recruit all these people from all over the world, train them with our own special
forces.
So was
Saddam, by the way.
Well, indeed, that's right. So in other words, the official story, and I got a letter in the London Review of Books about this at the time. The official story is that we created Al-Qaeda. We know we did. Hmm. We created it. It was MI6 and CIA and the French Secret Service that created Al-Qaeda. It wasn't a homegrown thing. We created it with the Saudis.
You're reminding me, Martin, didn't you actually face-to-face have a chit-chat with Channel 4's John Snow?
Yes, I did. I was just coming
John
to that.
Snow
I was just
it,
coming
you
to
were.
That.
Okay, okay.
So anyway, I saw this, that was reported that the French Secret Services had said... And this was before the attack on Afghanistan, so somebody in the French Secret Services was probably trying to sort of queer the pitch for the Brits and the Americans. And they said, well, he'd been visited by the CIA in November in Dubai, where he was in a hospital. Anyway, I went to the cinema in Notting Hill in London, And I noticed that it was a late night showing, and Jon Snow, who was a presenter for Channel 4 News, was in the cinema to watch whatever we'd gone to watch. And normally, you know, you see people like that in the cinema late at night, and you wouldn't approach them because, you know, they're on their time off. You know, that you don't, you know, you just give them a break. But I thought, because it had been on Channel 4 News, because it wasn't just in The Guardian, it had been on Channel 4 News, they'd reported it. So I went over to him at the end of the show and I said, excuse me, you're Jon Snow, aren't you? He said, yes, I am. I said, well, I wouldn't normally, you know, bother you, but on the Channel 4 News the last night or the night before, you said that the French Secret Services had said that he'd been visiting, that the CIA had been visiting Bin Laden in the hospital. And he said, that's right. And he said to me, but we wouldn't have used the story if we didn't have a second source. And the second source was the British doctor who carried out the operation on Bin Laden. So that's what he confirmed to me. So in other words, the CIA had very definitely been to talk to Bin Laden in November.
Yeah. And which year was that, sorry?
This is in 2001. So actually before, wasn't it? So in other words, the attack had already happened,
right.
But they're still going to see him and give him...
So even on the world news, Bin Laden is most wanted. I mean, this is why I remember what William Cooper, the American talk show host, said at the time. He said when they had a CNN interview with Bin Laden, and he was saying, what a load of rubbish. The CNN, a little silly camera crew, can find him and interview him, but the CIA are hunting him all over the world. They can't find him. He said, this is really dodgy. And he said, watch this guy. He's going to do an attack on America. That's what he said in July 2001.
Yeah. In other words,
several months beforehand. But
I mean, I think a lot of evidence of things of foreknowledge means that, I mean, coming, just to change the subject slightly, the Times of Israel informs us that in November of some years ago now, I can't remember which year it was, just before COVID kicked in, in December, in China, the Israeli Defense Forces were tipped off by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America that there was going to be a pandemic coming from China. And that means that whoever in the Defense Intelligence Agency knew that there was going to be a pandemic. That implies foreknowledge. So we've got foreknowledge of COVID, foreknowledge of 9/11, foreknowledge of 10/7.
There's another point here that relates back to what Israel, the modus operandi of Israel right now, which is to claim that they're going after Hamas, right? And to get the hostages back. But anytime they get an opportunity to actually do a deal to get the hostages back, suddenly they don't do it.
Well, they kill the guy that they're negotiating with, actually.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Yeah. And so it's like a MacGuffin in a film, isn't it? This thing you're supposedly chasing after. And in fact, something else is really going on. And so it could be the same with Bin Laden. And certainly when you listen to the guys that went in and got Bin Laden and took him out, they did say that they tried to get permission to do it. And they said, look, we've got really good intelligence of where he is. We're going to go after them. And they didn't actually get an approval. They just went ahead and did it. So, that's quite strange as well. It's not proof of anything, but it certainly, you know, it could show that they went
there. They dumped his body at sea somewhere, didn't they? No evidence.
That's right.
Just 1 million
people. Take some DNA sample or something, wouldn't you?
Important aspect to all of this is this whole idea of controlled demolition, because this Building 7 was most definitely controlled demolitioned. And looking at the Twin Towers, that looks like controlled demolition too. It doesn't look like the fires at the top actually brought it down at all. So the whole thing looks a little bit stage managed, and I mean, made for television, you know, terrorist event made for television.
I was actually in the World Trade Center a month before it went down. I was in the Windows on the World, which is right at the top, watching a band.
No, band.
And apparently, this is where the guy who had recently purchased the building had breakfast every day.
Larry Silverstein.
Except for, September 11. It was the one day he didn't go in.
Yeah.
His wife organized an emergency. So apparently he was sitting there every day. I was in there watching this great band. They were playing, another cinema reference, Morricone, Youth, they were called. And, so I was watching this band playing, the soundtrack to, Exorcist 2 with go-go dancers dancing. So that's sort of, and it does get weirder. I don't know if I should share this. I've never shared this publicly before. Maybe I should hold it back. No, I'll just go for it. I was a performance artist at the time, and I'd heard my uncle had told me about Bin Laden, and on the way from the Statue of Liberty, we were coming back on the ferry. He pointed out the World Trade Center. It was the first time I'd really looked at it, and he said this guy Osama Bin Laden had driven these SUVs underneath it and tried to blow it up. And I'd sort of looked at this as a sort of a young, you know, as a university, you know, quite aware of U.S. hegemony and dominance at the time. And certainly not like thinking that this was great, but also understanding that if you were in the, you know, the oppressed side of the world, gosh, that would be an incredible target to hit. So I was sort of, you know, it's obviously horrific, but a bit awestruck and interested in that power dynamic. Like, yes, there are people in the world that do want to undermine this capitalist sort of like.
Well, were you even thinking someone needs to send a message to the Americans to back off being the, you know, trying to outdo Adolf Hitler?
I mean, you know, you can understand where it comes from. I mean, it's clear where it comes from. That's not to say that it's justified. Of course, I wouldn't say that. I don't believe it's justified, but you can still understand where it comes from. So I actually did a, this is bizarre to admit, publicly. But I did a performance piece at the base of the World Trade Center, where I was, a Muslim terrorist with a, like a pretend sort of bomb explosive, and I was chanting and sort of like
was there any interest by the FBI or
nobody cared? You know, people were just walking straight past me. It's another crazy guy in New York, you know. But I filmed it and everything, and I've never looked at that tape because, you know, I came back to New Zealand and then the attack happened, and I was just like, wow, I'm not going to think about that. Like, I just obviously felt very weird because I certainly wasn't celebrating the idea of terrorism, you know, but I still felt very weird about
maybe
that.
You gave them the idea.
Yeah, that's right.
The 1993 attack. The 1993 attack where they put the bombs in the car parks.
Mm.
Yeah. What happened with that was that the FBI set up the whole attack. They recruited everybody. Yeah, the people who were involved in the attack didn't realise that they were being recruited by the FBI, but they recruited everybody, and they got people in the group that did it who were definitely FBI informants. And they went to the FBI. The FBI supplied the explosives to the group. And the people who were the FBI informants in the little group said, well, presumably we're going to arrest them when they're on the way to the World Trade Center with the explosives. Catch them red-handed. It was all set up. But the FBI said, no, we want it to go ahead. Mm. Six people died in that attack. There's no chance whatever that a bomb in a truck is going to blow up the World Trade Center from the basement. But it blew up, it killed a number of people, and then they were all immediately arrested because the FBI had set up the whole thing, like a lot of terrorist attacks in the US. Basically, every single person who's been convicted of terrorism in the US has been set up by the FBI. So in other words, they've said they choose people who look as if they might be gullible. They convince them that they ought to carry out some kind of attack, and then when they set off to do it, they're then arrested. Or they're allowed to go through with it, as they were in that case. Now, the FBI should have had to justify to the jury in the case, why did you let them actually let the bomb off? And, of course, why they did it is because it's preparing the population for further things that are going to happen later on. I'm quite sure that the planning for 9/11 probably began back in the 1960s with Operation Northwoods, where we've got the documents where the CIA was saying and the military was saying to Kennedy, what we're going to do is we're going to have a series of terrorist attacks in the US, including the hijacking of airplanes. We want a big death toll, and then we will say the Cubans did all that and we're going to invade
Cuba.
Wasn't
it specifically Northwoods involved an aircraft blown out of the sky?
That's right, involving aircraft
and
as
actually
well.
The plan, part of the plan was to just get US military and civilian clothes to book on that plane, but not actually get
that's
on
right.
the plane. So the plane would be downed, and they would say, oh, all these people have died, but actually no one would have been killed.
That's right. So in other words, and we've got evidence of the plan, because it was all leaked under Freedom of Information.
Lemnitzer, wasn't it?
Lemnitzer and also the other guy, what's his name? Curtis LeMay. But anyway,
he really was a nutter.
They were nutters. They were nutters. They passed it up. They passed it up to McNamara, who was JFK's consigliere, And both Kennedy and McNamara said, "You're bonkers, we're not doing anything like that." And they were miffed. Mm. They presumed that the president would just sign it off.
Love it, yeah.
And he didn't.
Genius.
And of course, he didn't sign it off. He knocked it back. But of course, consequences then flowed. But you can imagine that they didn't get what they wanted in that occasion, but they carried on plotting and planning. So the idea of setting up terrorist attacks inside the US so that we can then say we've been attacked by whoever it is, in this first case, the Cubans, in the second case, Al-Qaeda. And of course, as we've just said, Al-Qaeda was set up by the CIA and MI6. It's not like Hezbollah, which is an independent organization that's been created by people in Lebanon. Al-Qaeda was definitely set up by our own intelligence services.
Well, it's interesting, Matt.
Your
weird premonition, if you can call it that. Roger Cook, the British, actually he's a Kiwi, as a journalist here for many years. In fact, he over his program, The Cook Report, he got the highest rating current affairs show ever in Britain in the late 80s and 1990s. He did a program about 9/11, which was smuggling bombs onto planes at Logan Airport. And the whole program was all about how easy it is to smuggle a bomb onto a plane. We're going to try it. It was all done with hidden cameras and this sort of thing. And that was just literally a few months before the 9/11 attacks themselves.
Right.
Can I also mention that every single airport...
I'll put a link up to that, by the way, if you want to watch it, folks, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
The security in every single airport where planes took off that day was being run by private Israeli security company.
Ooh.
Who'd taken it over. The same with the London Underground. They don't have their own security. Can you remember the name of the company that was running the London Underground?
Well, it was a company
Verint
that was...
Verint Systems.
The CCTV. They were installing loads of CCTV in the tunnels of the London Underground. And they'd just been given the contract to do that a few months before. So they could go in the night time, basically. And what it looks like with 9/11... Sorry, with 7/7, is that the bombs were actually underneath the trains.
That's right.
And that the three guys who were on the underground train supposedly were patsies. But anyway, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But let's have a listen now to an excerpt from a very... Well, it's almost forgotten. Of course, the mainstream media would love you to forget this. This lady's name is Tanya Head, and back in 2012, there was a documentary about her, because she had been for many years... And this is what I'm talking about, stage managed, like, these kind of staged events made for television, is that she, for many years, had been, probably nearly a decade or so, had been the leader and the spokesperson for the New York 9/11 victims group. And of course there were hundreds of people who had lost loved ones were injured by the September the 11th attacks, mostly people who'd lost loved ones in the attacks. She apparently had been in the World Trade Center but managed to escape with her life, and so, but I suppose she must have run out or something. But anyway, it turned out in 2010 or so that actually she was a complete forgery. She never was anywhere near in fact, she was in another country on 9/11. And so for years, for the first decade or so after 9/11, this lady had been on the TV giving interviews about the views of the 9/11 victims' families. But she was actually not involved with the September the 11th attacks at all. The whole thing was a total fraud.
In the years after the 9/11 attacks, many stories have emerged of heroism, triumph, and tragedy. But one woman's extraordinary tale of survival against the odds stands out.
I was on the South Tower, and I lost my fiancé that day.
Tanya Head's story seemed tailor-made for a country in desperate need of inspiration.
Her story is the most tragic, but yet the most triumphant of all the stories. The perfect package.
Everyone fell for Tanya Head. Politicians, the press, the families of the dead heroes who became her friends.
We took her on just complete trust and faith. We had no reason not to believe everything she was saying to us.
But there was a flaw in Tanya's version of that terrible September day. It would prove devastating. When the planes hit the Twin Towers on the 11th of September 2001, Tanya Head wasn't even in New York.
Holy fuck!
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Patrice Blunt,
Lydia E. Bravo,
and my father, Michael Ernest Beekman,
and my father, John Patrick Bergen.
In the weeks and months after 9/11, as the nation grieved, the survivors, the ones that had got away, received little attention or sympathy. They were, after all, the lucky ones. Jerry Bogatz was lucky. He worked on the 82nd floor of the North Tower. The first plane hit 9 floors higher. He managed to walk out just 4 minutes before the tower collapsed. 3 members of his team were killed. Carrie Cohen Sullivan was lucky too. She'd only been working at the South Tower for 3 weeks when the planes hit. She survived simply because she didn't hear the announcements ordering her to stay at her desk.
I was so guilty for surviving. I was really young. All these other thousands of people are dead, but I'm still here. Most of it is due to luck. I worked on a low floor. I didn't stick around the area. I just left.
Soon there were 500 survivors signed up online and meetings with over 100 people. Amongst the new members, one woman's story stood out. Tanya Head said she was on the 78th floor of the South Tower. That made her one of only 19 people at or above the point of impact who survived. But incredibly, her fiancé died in the North Tower that day. Her vivid account of miraculous escape and tragic loss captivated everyone.
I looked around and it was like a horror movie. People were mounted on top of each other, the smell of burnt skin, and people's insides was gagging. I kept thinking about my fiancé, about our wedding. I wanted to wear that white dress and swear my love for him.
It was an amazing tale. It was that her fiancé was in Tower 1 and she was in Tower 2. Her fiancé was killed. Tanya was severely injured, managed to escape the tower before it collapsed, and then wound up in a hospital with a very severely injured and burnt arm.
Something gave me the strength to get up. I believe today it was my fiancé on his way to heaven. A firefighter took me in his arms the rest of the way out. When the tower came crashing down, we found cover. And the next thing I remember is waking up in the hospital.
Of all the amazing 9/11 survival stories, Tanya Head's was unparalleled. Up to now, everyone had taken Tanya on face value. On the 7th of September 2006, the New York Daily News ran an article telling the tale of Tanya's extraordinary escape from the 78th floor. The first time it had been written up in full. For most readers, it was a feel-good piece. But the journalists at the New York Times were puzzled. They'd already interviewed all the survivors from that floor. So who was this woman?
They wanted to do a story on Tanya Head, a nice story about the successes and all the wonderful things she'd been doing and head of this and head of that, and you know, how positively she turned around her terrible experience. He said, but there are just a few details that we can't, you know, just a few facts we can't seem quite to get.
Some discrepancies.
Yeah, he said, so maybe you could help us out. I said, well, I don't know that much about her, really, other than, you know, what she's told us, but I'll try. And so he said, well, what was her husband's name? I said, you mean she wouldn't tell you that?
She emailed me. These reporters are out to get me. Please don't share any information about me publicly. And I responded that I have nothing to hide about the Survivors Network, and I'm going to answer their questions. And there was one other exchange that I can't recall after that, where she was saying, fine, you know, I know you don't want to hide anything, but just don't say anything about me. And I said, I responded, I'm going to answer their questions. It would seem that you need to talk with them. Because at that point, she was refusing to talk with him. Yeah. That was the last contact I've had with her.
A week later, the New York Times ran a front-page story on Tanya. Every aspect of her story was called into question. Tanya Head was exposed as a fraud.
deception and lying. A woman who said she was a survivor of 9/11. She even met with then New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. It turns out it was all a lie.
I was on the South Tower and I lost my fiance that day.
Can we talk to you for a minute?
Neither Head nor her lawyer are talking. There is no evidence Head ever made money off her story, but she did make herself famous.
In February 2008, an email was sent to the Survivors Network from a Spanish account. It claimed Tania Head had committed suicide. It could be just one more story. No one knows for sure.
So, no evidence of a body, but she's vanished. This lady that was the spokesperson for all these New York victims, Martin, for nearly a decade.
Well, I mean, the management of the narrative surrounding 9/11 has been incredibly overwrought, hasn't it? I mean, this just, it's been used again and again as a justification for all sorts of things.
I mean, they didn't bring it up that much anymore, but it certainly was, the whole point of it seemed to be about justifying invading countries.
Yeah.
So something that would otherwise, you know, have to go through the Security Council, there'd be a vote, everybody would say, no, you can't do that, or they're a tussle. And in fact, even over Iraq, eventually the Security Council said, no, you're not going in, but they did anyway.
That's right. So, in other words, I mean, as a document project for a New American Century said, that, you know, we need to actually dominate the Middle East. We need to, you know, keep our empire solid. But absent some catastrophic event like a new Pearl Harbor, it's hard to see how the American population are going to go along with this. So it's there in black and white. Yeah. And of course, yeah. Pearl Harbor itself, many years later, it's now clear that that was a let it happen on purpose. The Japanese were pushed and they knew it was going to happen. That's why the carriers were all out of Pearl Harbor, and all that was left in Pearl Harbor was a load of old rust buckets, like the General Belgrano, which wasn't called the General Belgrano in those days, it was a US ship, but it survived Pearl Harbor, was sold to the Argentinians, and then ultimately sunk by HMS Tiger in order to start the Falklands War in 1981.
Well, actually, a lot of these big ships, these capital ships, the old style ones, they became a rope around the necks of the various navies, and they actually wanted to get rid of them. So maybe the Belgrano eventually sunk.
But the point is that the US aircraft, there were no US aircraft carriers in the harbour on the day because they knew an attack was going to come in.
Anyway, look,
they needed an attack in order to push the population in the US into World War II. Now, you know, that's the sort of thing that is done to try and get people to do what you want them to do. But of course, you know, this has been going on for a long time. It's not new. And the more you know about the history of these things, the more obvious it is.
You said something the other week, Martin, which was a bit of a moment of clarity for me. It may have been for our listeners too, where you were talking about, you know, Britain becoming more like America and America becoming more like Latin America.
Yeah.
One of the things that led to that, of course, was the other 9/11, which the former Labour MP Chris Williamson has been talking about, which was to do with Chile. Do you want to just explain what happened there with Allende? On 9/11, wasn't it?
The 11th of September 1974, I think it was. The military in Chile overthrew the democratic government and imposed a military dictatorship, you know, killing thousands of Chilean citizens. And of course, they were also heavily involved in Operation Condor, where people were being murdered across the southern cone of Latin America, all of which was orchestrated by the military in those countries, all of which had been trained and directed.
Well, you haven't mentioned
by the US.
You haven't mentioned the Secretary of State at the time.
Well, Henry Kissinger, yeah.
yes. As we've been saying.
As Kissinger said at the time, we can't allow a country to go communist just because of the irresponsibility of its own people.
So let's have a listen now to Chris Williams' little piece about that the other day.
Joining me now is Pablo Navarrete. Your parents left Chile to come to Britain as political refugees after they'd spent time in Pinochet's torture centres following the 1973 coup. I mean, that must have been an incredibly traumatic time for them.
Yeah, I mean, my parents were very young when the coup happened. My dad was 18 and my mum was 20, and they were both medical students at the University of Chile. They were part of a party, I guess, called the MIR, the Movement for of Independent Revolution, which were supporters of the, I guess, Cuban Revolution and supported Allende, but often critiqued Allende from the left for perhaps not going far enough. But they were certainly Allende supporters. And when the coup took place, something that some predicted was happening, there'd already been a failed coup before the 11th of September, 1973, like hundreds, well, the report that says close to just over 80,000 were tortured, but tens of thousands were rounded up and put into concentration camps, and they were included in those figures. So my mum was taken a few months after the coup by in a sort of general pickup that the Air Force did, and she was held for 3 days and then taken again in December 1974. My dad was actually arrested 2 days after the coup on the 13th of September and nearly killed during that arrest. A bullet went through his thorax, came out of his arm, and taken to the National Stadium, a famous where Chile plays its football matches today, and held with many people there. So it was, you know, and my mum subsequently went to some of the worst torture centres under the fascist dictatorship that followed the coup. So, yeah, they managed to survive, and unlike many of their comrades, and leave. My father arrived in May 1975, aged just 19, and my mum left in January 1976.
So that's on the Chris Williamson program. Sorry, I didn't catch the name of the guy, but Pablo Navarrete, actually, isn't it? But anyway, Martin, the whole business of the coup in Chile, this it's symptomatic of the U.S. post-war attempt to dominate. I actually visited Chile myself in the 1980s. And it was, yeah, it was something sort of dirty about the place, something wrong. Went to Santiago, Valparaiso, various other places. And I remember, always remember, never forget, on the beach in Valparaiso, just walking along by the sea there, this lady came up to us and said, look, I'm a poet and my friends are poets. Can you please, you know, you're a tourist. I said was from the UK. She got chatting and she said, well, look, I've got some poems. Can you please take them back to Amnesty in London? You know, we can't send anything out of the country. There's no way that we can get stuff out of the country other than through tourists like you. So I was very pleased to do that and got them to Amnesty International in London. But it was a pretty, crazy place. It was run by business people, basically, and there was no real checks and balances from the population at all. Now we've also, how does that fit in, do you think, to the other struggles in Latin America, Martin? What happened in Chile in September the 11th? That was 1973.
I think there have been many coups in the rest of Latin America. So coups were very much, I think Bolivia's had hundreds of coups.
We'll coup who we want to.
That's what Elon Musk said after the removal of Evo Morales, yeah. No, it wasn't Evo Morales, after Rafael Correa, wasn't it? Chile had a long democratic tradition, so there'd always been democratic governments in Chile for a long way back. So in many ways, it was a big shock for the Chilean left for there to be a military coup. But of course, the army in Chile had two main, if you look at their helmets, they're wearing Nazi style helmets, because traditionally the training for the Chilean army was done by the German army. And then of course they were all in the pockets of the US army. The School of the Americas in Georgia, that's where they trained virtually every Latin American military officer was trained there, and they were trained not really to fight, but in order to carry out coups against governments in Latin America that the US didn't like. And of course the Monroe Doctrine dates back to the 1820s, where they basically say the only people who are going to run anything in America are going to be us. Nobody else is allowed to come in here. They kicked the Spanish out at the end of the 19th century. And as far as they were concerned, all these countries were their countries. It's our backyard, as they called it. They still think of it as their backyard. And of course, what's going on now in Latin America is a huge struggle going on between the left and the right in most of these countries. Because of course, the right is strong in many of these countries. You've got a wealthy class in Brazil, in Colombia, where I was in 2005. And these wealthy people are not very happy at all when the left wing comes to power. So the US has got natural allies on the ground in all of these countries. And of course, many of these people keep their money in the US anyway, in dollars. This is what Hudson's pointing out about the Argentinian elite. They keep all their money in dollars in US banks. So they, as far as they're concerned, they don't actually suffer the problems that the ordinary population suffer through devaluation and inflation and so on. But it's a very finely balanced thing at the moment in Latin America. In Colombia, we've got the first left-wing government probably since the 19th century. But it's still, the wealthy classes, the drug cartels, the CIA ain't very happy with Gustavo Petro being the president of Colombia. But of course, one of the things he's doing is talking to the still existing, radical groups about putting down their weapons and joining, the mainstream political process. There's a long history of that.
In the Andes, there's quite a lot of Nazis turned up there, wasn't there? That's right. A famous place. Well, I say it's famous, probably not anywhere near as famous as it should be. It's probably some sort of tourist destination now. Colonia Dignidad, an isolated colony in Chile, actually, not in Argentina, it's just on the Chile side. It was formed by emigrant Germans. It became notorious for as an internment, torture and murder of dissidents during the military dictatorship of Pinochet in the 1970s. So yeah. There is this weird connection, isn't there, actually, between the Pinochet coup and secret Nazi. In fact, they weren't just camps. They were massive estates. In fact, they were running, very profit-making agricultural enterprises up in the Andes.
Well, as you know, the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which was written by,
Paul Manning.
Paul Manning, who was used to be, he was the top U.S. journalist in World War II.
CBS radio.
And of course, the rat lines took loads of ex-Nazis to Latin America, and of course they fitted in quite well with the wealthy classes down there. They were hidden by them. Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon, he went to Bolivia and he was hired by the CIA to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. And he was actually the guy in charge of the killing of Che Guevara. He didn't pull the trigger. But he was in charge of the operation for the Bolivian army. And he eventually was extradited to France and convicted for, torturing to death various French resistance people in Lyon. But in fact, he'd been protected by the CIA and used as a liaison with the Bolivian army. The guy who actually pulled the trigger to kill Che Guevara was later on went blind because he was just an ordinary soldier and actually pulled the trigger. He'd already been captured. He wasn't shot in a fight. And the Cuban doctors realized who he was when they were in Bolivia because they go all over the place, and they cured him of blindness. And he said that's how Cuba fights.
Well, that sounds like a miracle, but anyway.
Yeah, well, it's just true.
Just winding up our Latin American look, what about Javier Milei? Is that how you pronounce it? Milei? He is an anarcho-capitalist, very interesting, bizarre, peculiar guy with curly hair. I know nothing against people with curly hair. And glasses. He's been at the United Nations this week, as most presidents around the world have, denouncing the UN as a socialist organisation and also calling out the UN's hypocrisy for condemning Israel. So he's pro-Israel. This makes you wonder what on earth is going on down in, the Andes region, doesn't it, down there, well, having this guy now in charge. They've swung between left and right in Argentina. They've also had horrendous, the IMF has been destroying the country too. But this guy is a bit of a, he's also almost a kind of new generational anarcho-capitalist president that the world powers, the deep state, would rather like to have in charge.
Well, that's right. I mean, he's obviously a very dangerous, extremist right-wing person. And of course, there are wealthy people in Argentina who are very keen on having him in charge.
I thought anarchists were left-wing.
Well, some are, some aren't. You know, you can, you know, he's an anarcho-capitalist. He just doesn't, believe in any welfare for poor people, you know. Why should we pay to...
Money rules. For them, is that them? What they think? Money
well,
is
that's
just
right. That's right. It's a, basically, it's a worship of mammon, quite literally. I mean, that's what they're up for. And of course, he's also very much against any pushback against the people who were behind the military coup in Argentina in the first place.
His big bugbear is socialism. He's saying that it's cursed, cancerous, and it invites death. The Madrid has been demanding a public apology after these remarks directed at them.
Well, of course, yeah, because of course you have got a socialist-led government in Spain at the moment. But of course, you know, Argentina is... You know, all of these countries
are unique. But he's using this opportunity at the UN this week to get attention. This seems to be, you know, you make a really controversial, fiery speech, people will notice you. If you make a sort of pedestrian, boring speech about, you know, how we've got to stop war and there must be peace, then maybe less people will cover you.
I think what's very interesting in relation to this is that the right wing in Latin America are very pro-Israeli, and they're pro-Israeli for a reason. In Colombia, Petro is very anti-Israeli. That's because Ralph Etienne from Mossad organized the right-wing paramilitaries in Colombia. So Mossad have been very, very active in Latin America, working with the military dictatorships and the armies to suppress the popular movement. So the paras Colombia, the Auto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, and the other paramilitary right-wing groups, which are very heavily involved in narco-capitalism, also killed loads and loads and loads, thousands.
Well, that's a bit confusing, isn't it? Anarcho-capitalism and narco-capitalism. Well, without the "an" at the beginning, so this is to do with cocaine and heroin.
Yeah, but I mean,
you
cannot make a load of money out of drugs if it's legalized. So it's got to remain illegal so that you can make a load of money out of it. And so Uribe, who was the former president of Colombia, was regarded as probably the 40th in the world in terms of being a narco capitalist, you know, and in terms of, you know, he was a drug dealer. The cartels in Latin America are aligned with the CIA. Pablo Escobar's son said, you know, he made a speech about a statement to the media a couple of years ago, said, everybody knows that my dad worked with the CIA. Dogs in the street know. I went to Colombia in 2005. Everybody knows. There's no delusion about it. Everybody knows that the narcos and the CIA work together because what the illegal drugs market does is it creates a huge slush fund that you don't have to account for, and then you can pay paramilitaries to go around.
But surely the banks are keeping a very close check on this. No sorts of things are allowed by the banks, are they?
Well, no, because
HSBC, for example, in
2009, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime came out with a report about what had happened in 2008 with the banking collapse, and they said, well, what happened at that stage was all the dirty money that had been hanging around ready to be processed through the system was just processed in one go. So, in other words, the banks were saved, A, by the taxpayers, you know, the working class taxpayers of every country. They had to bail the banks out. And the other big saviour of the banks was the drug cartels.
Anyway, look,
they got loads of money.
Very socialist.
Well, that's right.
Selectively socialist.
Yeah. Socialism
it's a bit like
for the
US's hegemony. It's sort of selectively for human rights and democracy when it suits their interests, and as soon as it doesn't. And they're anti-terrorism until they're not. It's
used in the United States particularly, isn't it, as a sort of insult, socialist. But to me, you know, I was brought up under socialism here, really, a mixed economy, Harold Wilson, people like that. And it worked very well. It was the, you know, cheap water, cheap gas, cheap electricity. In fact, I could always remember, never forget when they went over to North Sea Gas. They had little crews going all around the country, just converting everyone's cooker from the old town gas, which smelt different, to North Sea gas. Just they come into your house, we'll have a look, and next week they come back, they change the various burners in for you, all for free. Because this is the gas board. We want you to be able to eat. We want you to be able to cook. We want you to be able to keep warm. And that was what they were there for, because they were part of the government. The meetings which ran it were open to the public. And so that was socialism, as far as I'm concerned. All the infrastructure of the country worked. Now, what we got, we've just heard this week that Britain has the most expensive electricity in the world.
It's almost as if running things for profit makes them more expensive and function less ideally.
So what can we do with Margaret Thatcher? Oh, she's gone, hasn't she? Margaret Thatcher. Yeah. Anyway, Britain's first great woman prime minister. Anyway, back to Britain, looking at the terrorism and the sort of 9/11 theme. Finally, let's have a little listen now to Daniel Obuchicki. He was a Londoner who was on the number 30, I think it was, bus, which was the bus bomb. He wrote a book called The Fourth Bomb about it, and he was interviewed at the time. I mean, I managed to interview him, actually. He did a very good presentation called The Peter Power Terror Drill Inquest, which was all about how this guy was managing to do a terror drill on the same day and then popping up on the TV talking about it, saying at the same three tube stations where the bombs went off, that's where the bombs were on our drill. He said it was a spooky coincidence. Well, maybe that's because you were a spook, Peter. Anyway, let's have a listen to Daniel Obuchicki now.
It took the police investigating anti-terrorist branch of Scotland Yard 7 months to question me. I actually called them, contacted the emergency information hotline the following day, but they didn't get back to me until the end of January in 2006, and I just felt it was as though they were trying to whitewash me to make out that I was not even there, to actually completely make it look as though I was not even on board the bus. I had some surveillance, I don't know whether they were MI5, anti-terrorist branch, or what government organization, but I had a lot of probing. I even gave an interview with a journalist called Duffy. He was working for the Sunday Mirror, and he showed me a picture. This was a week after the actual 7/7. He showed me a picture of Hasib Hussein, and then he asked me, have you seen this person? And I said no. And about a day or two after that, then it was Hasib Hussein was named as the bus bomber in the British press. And I was downstairs. I saw no Asian guy at all, none carrying a rucksack at Euston or on the bus or at Tavistock Square.
Yeah, so that's Daniel Obuchicki there. I'll put a full version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. If you're interested in listening back to him, because he's been virtually erased from history, really. But he was there on the bus. He gave a he said actually he did see some guy get on the bus with a rucksack, get off the bus, the stop before the bomb went off with no rucksack, and he thinks he was the bomber, and he describes him, but the police weren't interested, Martin.
Well, that's right. And obviously we looked into all of this at the time when we were making the film Mind the Gap, and I think it's probably still out there on the internet if people want to find it.
It certainly is. Yeah, there are some others, aren't there? I remember right at the very start there was one called BT. I don't know what that was, but it popped up online pretty much straight away with lots and lots of questions about holes in the story, really, to do with 7/7.
Well, I think one of the most devastating holes in the story, which we were able to uncover, was that people we know went to Connex Rail in Luton some months after the bombing, and they said, well, what happened on the day? And Connex Rail told them that, in actual fact, we've been waiting for the police to come and talk to us because the train that they claimed the bombers caught did not run on that morning. And ultimately, John Reid, who was the Home Secretary, Scottish guy, he had to go to the House of Commons and say, well, actually, it's come to light that, in actual fact, the train that the bombers supposedly caught that day didn't run, but it doesn't change anything about the main story. It's a minor thing.
Yeah, that's right, but it did, didn't it? Because
they couldn't have been in the times and places they said they were if the train didn't run. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it sound as if they almost sat there and looked at a train timetable and said, I know, well, let's make out that they went on this train from there to there.
That's right. But
and
we,
that was the
we,
flaw in their story, the police, was that train was cancelled that morning.
The question that obviously comes to mind is, why didn't the police go and ask Connex Rail about the train times? It took independent citizen journalists to go there and find it out. But we got a direct hit there. They had to admit in the House of Commons that the train time was wrong. Now, that, in fact, invalidates the whole narrative that the government had been telling us about what happened on that day. And, of course, because we've had a civil war in this country, you know, in Ireland and all the rest of it, people know when that's something's wrong like that. Yeah. In a different kind of country, people say, well, it doesn't really matter. But in this sort of country, we know about things like this. They can't possibly have been on the train. Then that means the whole story is a fake. And, of course, we know we've got eyewitnesses saying that the bombs were under the trains. They were already on the tracks. Yeah. And if you look at the photographs of the bomb after the trains after the bomb, it's all blown up from in, and the windows were blown in, not out.
I will put a link up on our show page to at least a couple of those documentaries. First of all, the Mind the Gap one we were talking about earlier, which we premiered here at the Cube Cinema in Bristol back in 2006. And also, the one called Ludicrous Diversion, which I think came out just before Adrian's one, or around about the same time, which to me is an it's obviously someone who's worked in professional television journalism has put that documentary together. One of the key things they say there, Martin, is talk about the Inquiries Act, saying, well, actually, public inquiries in Britain now are political. They're not judicial. They're part of the political system because ministers decide or appoint people to run them. Ministers say what the remit is of the inquiry. In fact, it's all under political control, so it's not really a public inquiry. It's not a judicial process at all anymore.
Well, that's precisely the position of the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland. They want a full investigation into collaboration and collusion between the British security forces and loyalist paramilitaries, but they don't want it to be carried out under the auspices of the British state because they don't trust the state. They want an international inquiry into that. And that's their position. And incidentally, this new Labour government has in fact decided to have an inquiry, a British inquiry, into the assassination of Pat Finucane, because there's loads of evidence to suggest that he was set up by the state. But of course, he was just he was just one person. What really went on in the Northern Ireland Troubles is still worthy of a lot of investigation, because the British Army's Force Research Unit, run by Brigadier Gordon Kerr, they were definitely running the Loyalist paramilitaries. But what's rather shocking on the Republican side is how more and more evidence is coming out that he was running top-level agents inside the IRA as well. So that Brian Nelson, who was Chief Intelligence Officer of the UDA, and Scapitacci, who was...
Sorry, they were there, for people that don't know, they were... The Loyalists.
Ulster Defence Association, and they were involved in lots of murders. And,
Loyalist terrorists.
Yeah, and also Scapitacci, who was head of the internal security for the Provisional IRA, he was also an agent of Brigadier Gordon Kerr. So in other words, a lot of the bombs and shootings and killings that went on in Northern Ireland, the British Army were directly involved in all of them.
Maybe we might find out a lot more than we know now. Ordering them.
Oh, that's right, yes. Ordering them.
Being, you know, basically saying, right, this guy's going to be killed,
that's right.
Would you say it's, because, you know, there's a lot of evidence that's come out about Netanyahu's love for Hamas and funding for Hamas.
Yeah.
Do you think it's fair to make comparisons between the way things are being run over in Gaza, where it's almost as if the idea is to control both sides of the chessboard through secret intelligence services?
Well, I mean, even if they were playing a straight bat, you would obviously, they would obviously be trying to infiltrate all these different organisations, you know.
Well, and they funded Hamas for the specific reason that they didn't want to have the PLO and Arafat, because this was a much broader organisation. They wanted to be able to characterise the opposition as Islamist, specifically.
Yes, they did.
And that's, I think, the reason. I mean, it certainly seems that up until very recently, they were still being funded by the
Israelis.
That's
right. Well, I mean, the point about it was that Hamas were taking a line of, we're not going to recognise the Oslo agreements. Yeah. Whereas the PLO had basically said, we're going to accept a two-state solution. Now, Netanyahu and the right wing in Israel do not want a Palestinian state at all. And, of course, Knesset, not that long ago, passed an overwhelming motion that they will never accept a Palestinian state under any circumstances. Now, they were under pressure from the outside world, once Arafat had signed the Oslo agreement, that, you know, you've got to start, you know, getting, you know, you've got to give them a state. That's what you've agreed to.
Which year are we talking about here?
We're talking, that was in the end of the 90s, wasn't it?
Mid-90s, wasn't it? Oslo? Yeah. And then Rabin was assassinated.
That's right.
By Netanyahu's mate.
Well, by,
and then possibly. Netanyahu came to power.
Yeah. So in other words, the more you look into this, it's a wilderness of mirrors, you know. Anybody who's read a John le Carré novel or seen a film about spying will know that it's all about, you know, if you've got one top level spy in the other side's infrastructure, that's what you want, you know. And that's exactly what Brigadier Gordon Kerr was doing. The loyalists knew they were working with the British Army. They even boasted about it. The Republicans, on the other hand, were very keen that they weren't going to be infiltrated, etc. But sadly, from their point of view, they were. I mean, they were very shocked when it came out that Donaldson, who was a political guy, was working for the British for years. I think that very recently in Northern Ireland, of course, the Tories were trying to push through this bill, which would say that all of the attacks that happened before Good Friday Agreement, everybody associated with that, we're just going to wipe the slate clean and pretend none of it ever happened. Now, in actual fact, nobody on any side in Northern Ireland was willing to accept that. The Loyalists weren't willing to accept it because it thought it was letting the IRA off the hook. The Provisionals weren't, and the Republicans weren't willing to accept it because they thought letting the British Army off the hook. And everybody in the middle ground was saying, well, no, we didn't agree to that. We said people who were already in prison, as long as they agree not to carry out any more terrorism, we'll let them go. But we're not saying that we're not going to look into things that happened previously. One of the things that Starmer has done right when he became Prime Minister was he killed that idea. He said it because the real reason why the Tories were pushing it is they don't want Brigadier Gordon Kerr in the dock, because he knows everything about everything that happened in Northern Ireland, and it was paid for by our taxes.
Okay, we've got a couple of topics to discuss before we go to the break. First of all, COVID. This is probably 2 years ago now. I'm not sure of the exact date. Roughly 2 years ago. I interviewed a chap called Dr. David Hughes from Lincoln University. I had a chat with David this week, and he's not anymore at Lincoln University. He's taken early retirement because their university is basically in all sorts of financial trouble. The interview I did with him is called What's in the COVID Vaccines, with a big inverted commas around, well, just normal size actually, around the word vaccines, ? Evidence of Crimes Against Humanity, Dr. David Hughes' paper. Another paper has come out recently justifying and backing up what he's saying about rather strange things being found in people's bodies and in the actual vaccines before they've been put into people's bodies that don't look like they should be there. Like sort of square objects. And there was the well-known YouTuber, Dr. John Campbell, picked up on this latest peer-reviewed report, which is also questioning what's in the COVID vaccines. Immediately, it was censored from YouTube, which gives him a strike. So he's quite brave putting these things up on YouTube, but it's quickly appeared in various other places. So let's have a listen now to Dr. John Campbell, this peer-reviewed paper describing what he calls nanostructures in COVID jabs.
In addition to cellular toxicity, as if that wasn't bad enough, our findings reveal numerous on the order of 3 to 4. So that's between, that's 10 to the 6, that's 3 to 4 million of these artifacts per mil of the injectable. Heck, that's 4, that's 4, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, up to 4 million, between 3 and 4 million, dear me. Visible artifacts, self-assembling entities, ranging from about 1 micrometre to about 100 micrometres, 100 microns, or greater, of many different shapes. As we said, one micrometre is about the size of a bacterial cell. If you've got good young eyes, you could probably just about see an object of 100 micrometres. It's a tenth of a millimetre, isn't it, with the naked eye, at a push. I probably couldn't at my age, but maybe with my glasses. Anyway, the researchers go on. They were animated worm-like entities, disc-chained spirals, tubes, right-angled structures, containing other artifactual entities within them. Artifacts within artifacts. All these are exceedingly beyond any expected and acceptable level of contamination of the COVID-19 injectables. Well, I would have thought 3 to 4 million per mil is way off the scale. Indeed. Now, an incubation study's revealed the progressive self-assembly of many artifactual structures. What the heck are they? As time progressed during incubation, simple one- and two-dimensional structures over 2 or 3 weeks became more complex in shape and size, developing into stereoscopically visible entities in three dimensions. These became three-dimensional structures in their incubated cultures designed to replicate the conditions inside the human body. They resembled carbon nanotube filaments, ribbons, tapes, some appearing as transparent thin flat membranes, others as three-dimensional spiral beaded chains. Some of these seem to appear then disappear over time. Our observations suggest the presence of some kind of nanotechnology in the COVID-19 injectables. Now, this is directly from peer-reviewed literature. I don't expect you'll see it. I suspect strongly that I am currently talking to myself in a back room in Carlisle somewhere. If some of you do get to see it, then you consider that a bonus. You can think about it.
Well, that's just an excerpt from that video. Look, this is what he's talking about here is nanostructures self-assembling in your body after being injected. Now, that sounds like the sort of nutty conspiracy theory where people are saying that, Martin, where there's you're having sort of some kind of chip injected into you when you have a jab. But he's not quite saying that, is he? He's saying that there may be something self-assembling. In other words, that the material is somehow able to program your cells to build things in your body.
Well, I mean, this evidence is creeping up, isn't it? I don't follow this as closely as I follow some other things, but my mind is open about this. But I will also point out that nobody in Russia or China has received any kind of Western pharmaceutical injection. They created the Sputnik vaccine, and they created the Sinopharm vaccine, which, of course, the Pentagon then tried to stop people in the Philippines from taking the Sinopharm vaccine. So
that's disgusting. Because deliberately actually, the Chinese vaccine. I mean, I know you're a big fan of China. I'm not such a fan, but this was the only COVID vaccine which was a traditional vaccine, which had taken the COVID virus, denuded it, and then that was injected into people. The idea being, here's a kind of tame version to help your body.
It was also a great deal cheaper.
Used misinformation planted some story about it to discredit it as well, so that the Philippines wouldn't purchase it. So that we're coming back to what we were saying before about what's going on now, and we were talking about conspiracy theorists, but now the terminology is more often about misinformation, isn't it? And of course, we know that the greatest exponents of misinformation in the world are who are they? Yes, the very people making these claims.
The mainstream media, I think, so the biggest spreaders of disinformation in the world, which hence they have to have their fact check units and what's it called, BBC Verify, sitting up the pyramid at the top of the BBC newsroom, watching everything, Mariana Spring and her friends.
Yeah, got to control the narrative. And you're talking about how has the world changed since 9/11. Obviously, for better and worse, whatever you think was the cause of 9/11, they certainly, no one can deny, it's very clear that they cynically used it as an excuse to invade countries that had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks at all. If you just go by the nationalities of the hijackers that the story, is that there were 15 of them were from Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, is an ally of the United States in the Middle East. And I want to make a quick note. This week I found a really good argument by Noam Chomsky, by the way, just as a side note here, that if anyone thinks that the US necessarily planned the attack. He said, why would you, if you planned and controlled the entire thing and you were the United States, why on earth would you make the passports of the hijackers be from Saudi Arabia as opposed to Iraq? Wouldn't it? But anyway, as I say, regardless of how or who or what, they certainly used
it. I would answer Nome, and then I would say, well, hang on, because we're setting up these guys like Mohammed Atta, these guys. We've got a bunch of people we're setting up to be, and we want them to look Arabic, you know. So long as they're from a country which is kind of, you know, somewhere in the Middle East, then people will just think, oh yeah, well, they're probably Iraqis, aren't they?
Well, it seems slack. Like, if you're going to plan that properly, I would want to have Iraqis, mostly Iraqis. So to me, it seems to fall in line personally with more a let it happen potential, or hey, it's happened and we're going to make use of it. But of course, there's plenty of evidence that could be a lie hop.
Yeah,
I like
definitely,
that.
Yeah.
I think that's
strong. Were talking at the time a lot about this whole thing of my hop and lie hop, as Martin mentioned earlier, make it happen on purpose or let it happen on purpose. So a lot of this work, actually, Martin, to give him credit, was done by Webster Tarpley, getting that sort of stuff out, wasn't it? He did a really good analysis of a lot of the things to do with September the 11th attacks back at the time. But anyway, we mustn't get too far off at the moment.
I thought I could come back to...
You will in a moment, but I just want to finish on a little item on COVID here, there's a guy called Dr. Richard Ebright who's been making a lot of, I think, excellent points about whether it was a lab leak or whether it was a bat and a pangolin and this kind of thing. Mm. So this kind of stuff does sort of trickle out, folks. And so every now and again when I hear it, I think, yes, well done. You know, you've done a good presentation there. Let's hear it on the show. Martin, this whole idea, isn't it, of a lab leak was that we had Jeremy Farrar from the Wellcome Trust, who was probably, I don't know if he was in the building next to my secondary school when I was a nipper, but anyway, the Wellcome Trust were right next door to us, Burroughs Wellcome, when I was growing up. And Jeremy Farrar has now been made Chief Scientific Officer of the World Health Organization, but he was the guy right at the very start who, even though he knew it was possibly a lab leak, he said, look, let's just put out all this stuff about the bats and the pangolins to the press and let them suck it up. I mean, that was deliberate, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Jeffrey Sachs who's a, you know, senior US academic. I mean, he's an economist, basically. But he was put in charge of trying to find out the source of COVID by The Lancet, which is, you know, a very well-respected medical journal. And he approached Peter Daszak of EcoHealth Alliance, and he gave him the role of going to China to look into the origins of COVID. But Peter Daszak did not inform his line manager,
Jeffrey Sachs,
that in fact he was, the Pentagon was actually investing in the Wuhan lab. DARPA was investing in the Wuhan lab, and they were investing in gain-of-function research on coronaviruses. Now, you'd have thought that if Daszak had been told by Jeffrey Sachs to go, he would have said to Jeffrey Sachs, well, I've just got to put my hand up here, because in actual fact, we have been working with this lab, and that's what they've been doing. But he didn't do that. And of course,
that must have been a hell of a wake-up moment for Jeffrey Sachs. Well, hang on, you mean the guy I've sent there guy that did it?
No, as soon as he realised that he'd been deceived by Daszak, he sacked him and said, right, well, that just shows me that you're not being honest with me here. And of course, it became obvious, and Sachs said this, that the virus had been modified. It's a modified virus. Now,
yeah. Engineered.
There was that phone call with Fauci, wasn't there? Prior to that, the group of scientists that were asked to look at it, the genome structure, the majority of them had said, gosh, wow, look at that. There's no way that could come from nature, right? The fur and cleavage sites. And then there's a phone call with Fauci, and then the very next day, the tune is completely different. Yeah. I believe it was also some sort of a donation to different research projects from Fauci to some of these scientists as well. I don't know if that was a coincidence, but they completely changed the tune, and the next day more or less turned right about to saying, no, we're quite certain, but there wasn't... But I read a report by, was it on The Intercept, suggesting that there's actually nothing in their findings to prove, to show why they came so heavily down on the conclusion that it couldn't be.
I would suggest you read the emails from good old Jeffrey Sachs. It's probably Sir Jeffrey Sachs, the Right Honourable Sir, not Jeffrey Sachs. No. Oh God, the guy from the Wellcome Trust, Jeremy Farrar. Mm. He's the bloke who was very much involved in making sure, as soon as it came out, right at the very start of COVID, when it looked as if all the evidence was about to move towards a lab leak, then he made sure everything went in the opposite direction.
You know what the best proof of this whole thing is as well, to me. I must find it, but there was a tweet by my dear friend Mike Pompeo, who of course I trust always.
Yeah,
I mean, very straightforward guy.
You're quite like that.
He's the guy that plotted to murder my dear friend Julian Assange. But a broken clock is right twice a day, and this guy would have no reason to lie about this that would serve his interests. Pompeo tweeted saying that China should be held responsible for the COVID virus from the Wuhan lab but the United States should be responsible for funding the research. A guy that plugged into the Matrix would have nothing to gain by coming out and basically proving, you know, saying this, that really gives so much credence to all the other evidence that it was a manufactured virus that was, you know, partly
who's going to phone up the boss of the CIA and tell him he's not allowed to say that?
Yeah, but why? Yeah, exactly. And that, to me, it just proves because he would have nothing to gain by lying about that. It's causing a blowback for the United States, a huge one.
The obvious question for you, Martin, is China must have known.
Well,
this is on Chinese soil.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the question for the Chinese would be, why did we let that happen? Yeah? Because...
Isn't it? It's just a faction within China.
Well, no.
A deep state in China. Surely that can't exist.
I know, but listen, it's not in the interest of the Chinese deep state to leak this stuff in...
unless they're colluding with the Yanks.
Yes, well, they might
Legal in China to do gain and function
apparently
research?
It was, and that's why they were doing it there, because it had been banned in the US.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I can imagine...
they're the evil empire then, aren't they?
Yeah.
And in the Ukraine...
Kirillov, who is
Hunter
the head,
Biden's laptop.
Yes, Hunter Biden was involved with Burisma Holdings, which were definitely involved in these labs, and Nuland admitted that they were indeed carrying out gain of function research in these labs. And of course, when the Russian army went in there, they captured these labs pretty quickly because they were obviously a target, and they've gone through all of the documentation. And Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare troops, has gone to the UN and said, we've got evidence that they were carrying out gain-of-function research in these labs, including upon COVID-19.
Wow.
We think that this was deliberately created virus. Now, that's not in our media. Yeah.
No,
it's not the BBC don't report this, but it has, of course, been reported in Russia.
Just get back
to the head of their biological
I knew that's what they're afraid of when they talked about, we don't want these viruses to get into Russian hands, these labs. It's more that they didn't want them to get the proof that United States is...
That's right.
Great.
And of course, soon after the COVID outbreak, Salami, who took over from Soleimani as the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, he came out and said, we think this is a biological warfare attack because we got what happened with Iran. The second outbreak, it started in China and started spreading from China, but there was an independent outbreak of COVID in Iran, and it didn't come in through an airport, and it didn't come in through a port. It was at Qom's, which is actually the holy city in Iran, where all the clerics and the, you know, it's like
mullahs, imams, all that.
That's right. That's where they go. They've got all their sacred mosques there and everything. And he said, and the other thing that made us suspicious, it was a different strain from the Chinese strain.
If you were a very, very evil person. I mean, like, about as evil as you can get. What you would want to do would be to find a disease which was incredibly contagious but fairly innocuous and something to it which would kill people. So,
yeah, and it only kills
elderly
folk.
Isn't that what the Chinese and the I think it was what the Chinese and and Fauci did in Wuhan. Anyway, let's have a listen to this guy now talking about the lab leak theory. His name is Dr. Richard Ebright.
I assess that a large preponderance of evidence indicates SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, entered humans through a research incident. Four key facts support my assessment. First, COVID emerged in Wuhan, a city that is 800 miles from the closest bats harboring SARS-CoV-2-like viruses that could have served as progenitors of SARS-CoV-2, but that contains lab that prior to the outbreak were conducting the world's largest research program on bat SARS viruses, possessed the world's largest collection of bat SARS viruses, and possessed the virus most closely similar to SARS-CoV-2. The large distance between Wuhan and bats harboring SARS-CoV-2-like viruses points away from a natural origin of COVID, and Wuhan's status as the global epicenter of research on bat SARS viruses points toward a research origin of COVID. Third, Wuhan labs performed this research on SARS viruses using an inadequate biosafety standard, just biosafety level 2, and inadequate personal protective equipment, just gloves and a lab coat. Lab accidents that result in infection or release are common, even at biosafety levels higher than biosafety level 2. For context, the original SARS virus, SARS-CoV-1, caused lab-acquired infections in Singapore at biosafety level 3, in Beijing twice at biosafety level 3, and in Taipei at biosafety level 4. For further context, SARS-CoV-2 itself caused lab-acquired infections in Beijing in 2020 at biosafety level 3 and in Taipei in 2021 at biosafety level 3. The Wuhan lab's use of biosafety level 2 for research on bat SARS viruses would have posed a high risk, a very high risk, of infection of lab staff upon encountering a virus having the aerosol transmission properties of SARS-CoV-2. Taken together, the presence of a spike having an extremely high affinity for human SARS receptors, the presence of a furin cleavage site inserted at the spike S1-S2 border, the genome sequence enabling assembly from six synthetic nucleic acid building blocks using the reagent BSMB1, and the 1-4-1 match between these features and the features proposed in the 2018 NIH and DARPA proposals make an extremely strong case, a smoking gun, for a research origin. In summary, multiple lines of secure evidence point to a research origin. By contrast, as I hope I will have the opportunity to review in response to questions, no, zero secure evidence points toward a natural origin. Thank you.
So, Jeremy Farrar, stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Well, look, that chappy is Dr. Richard Ebright in the States. I mean, there's loads of technical stuff in there. A lot of that technical stuff, by the way, was covered by Greg Felton in his book, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, I think it's called, SARS-CoV-2. One of the first books out about the lab origin and the all the conspiracy theories, effectively, a brilliant investigation into the way that the SARS virus was engineered to and then spread around. I mean, the actual sort of physical details. But in a way, Martin, the most interesting thing he's talking about there is he's saying they're wearing the wrong coats. You know, they haven't got proper gloves on, you know, in this lab. So it's almost bound to leak.
I come back to what I said earlier, that we know the Times of Israel, and it's been pointed, it's also been on the television in Israel. They have told us that they were told by the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States of America before the December outbreak of COVID, that there was going to be a pandemic coming from China. It's not an accidental lab leak. It's a deliberate biological warfare attack, which is what the Iranians and the Russians have been saying for over 2 years, not reported in our media, but that's what they think it was.
Well, speaking of those, there's another person that's written a book about this, his name of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Oh, yeah, of course.
He got a lot of blowback for saying that the COVID-19 affects those who are non-Jewish and those who are non-Chinese more than converse. And now, just this week, Robert Kennedy has said that he said something very interesting happened. Robert Redfield, who he says he really went after in his book, on his Fauci book and all the rest of it, he is the head of the CDC, Center for Disease, and I forgot the last C means. Anyway, very involved, and he attacks him heavily throughout his book. But this week, Robert Redfield went to Robert F. Kennedy, asked him to meet him for lunch, said he was going to endorse Trump purely because Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was going to head up the health attack plan, and told him, the first thing he said to him was, "You got everything right." So this is the guy that he criticizes all through his book.
And this is for those of you who are interested in how you unvaccinate yourself. A lot of people thinking like that. Patricia has penned a poem this week on those very lines. So it's called Jab Remorse, Hope on Course. A jab in arm so many took, the lies, the spinner, hook by crooks, danger in each body see, the clots from shots, a travesty. Too many fooled, 'tis such a shame, so many dead, too many maimed, the worry now in every heart, who took the jab, don't wish to part this world before their time is up. Fear not, dear hearts, a plan afoot, rid lipids, spikes of blood may find, Peter McCulloch gives peace of mind, rich search now seems, 'tis underway, reverse the damage, come what may, to help the jabbed, this hope now could, clean up the mess now in the blood. An off switch found deep in the dirt from killer jabs that folk have hurt. Ribotech, which just may be the therapy to set folk free. Have faith and hope and understand a protocol. Be hand in hand. Hope in heart with remedy might put these wrongs perhaps to right. Keep people on an even keel. An antidote in time may steal. Pray rid the world this putrid crime with research a cure, for this may find a protocol of spike detox, help rid the blood of all this rot. Thank you again, Patricia.
So I want to know a bit about Julian, because there's this event.
Yeah, that's probably
next
more
week.
Interesting to talk about. I agree.
Yeah, next week.
Yes, very
Julian
important.
Is appearing, isn't he? Sort of, he's been, I think, isn't he been kind of swimming and relaxing in the sun?
Beautiful.
In Australia, but what about this comeback?
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, it's what a lot of people have been waiting for. and as you say, he's gone to ground, and his plan was to maintain that and just have a peaceful recovery. But he's decided to make this one exception to break that, purely because of what an incredible opportunity this is. So he's been invited by the Legal Affairs Committee for PACE, the Parliamentary Assembly Council of Europe, who have declared that he is was a political prisoner, and that his detention and his imprisonment is a massive chilling effect on human rights, specifically on press freedom, of course. And so what they've invited him to do is to speak, and he is taking the opportunity. He's flying from, his secret hideout in New South Wales in Australia. He's where, as you say, he's been swimming. He's going to go to Strasbourg, and this is on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday in the morning, 8:30 a.m. European Central Time. Is that right? And you can tune in live. It's going to be publicly streamed on YouTube. Go to PACE TV. So mark that in your diary, 8:30 a.m. Tuesday, October 1st, and Central European Standard Time. That's it.
So is this something that WikiLeaks is publicising?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it's been tweeted out by WikiLeaks, by Julian's brother and his wife, and they've stressed how this is an exception. You know, he's not going to be doing other talks or press. You know, this is purely because of the significance of this.
Yeah, but he might enjoy it, mightn't he? So it might not be the only time.
No, I don't think he's ready. That's the sense. You can get this real strong sense from what WikiLeaks and Gabriel, his brother, said, that this is an exception, that he's generally not ready for this type of... I mean, you can only imagine, put yourself in his shoes as someone who's sort of maligned by the media and sort of for 14 years, basically, smeared and silenced. So the whole world you know, feeling like the whole world's against him, locked in a little concrete box in the dark, you know, it's going to take him some time to recover his strength, to face the glare of media again, to tell his story in a way that he feels comfortable and confident. But he's going to bite it off and do it this Tuesday. So tune in. And the other important part of it is not just to hear a story, but in the context that the council, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe will be voting the next day on whether or not to, ratify these actions, that, the United Kingdom be asked to investigate his, mistreatment, degrading and inhuman treatment, which is, of course, torture, and also for the United States, who is an observer nation of the Council of Europe. I didn't realize this, but they can be asked to reform the Espionage Act, which has been used since September 11 to go after whistleblowers and now journalists. Yeah, look, and that is the most important.
The European Union doesn't have a great record in telling the US what to do. It's more kind of the other way around.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, you can always throw that in there. And, you know, no, there's no guarantee. You ask someone to do something that they're going to do it.
The bad cop doesn't always listen to the good cop.
I think that it would still be the most weighty sort of alliance of, you know, of vested interests, calling for the right thing to be done here. It's just another, you know, log on the fire for us to try to burn that Espionage Act, which to me is now the most dangerous legal instrument in the world. And given that they've gone after not just whistleblowers in the United States, but an Australian journalist working in England and alleging that you cannot publish any classified documents, even if they reveal state crimes by the US.
Well, I'm no genius, but I would guess that the Israelis love the Espionage Act because that's the sort of thing that they do rather like to silence journalists. So let's have a listen now. I spoke this week to Granville Williams. He's the former editor of a magazine called Free Press. He now runs something called Media North. And if you want to have a listen to the full interview, which will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. It gives you all the gen about how to follow Media North. It's really the only, other than the Press Gazette, a magazine for journalists in Britain, but it's specifically a campaigning magazine. And I spoke to Granville this week about the Israeli Defence Force shutting down Al Jazeera's offices in the West Bank.
Al Jazeera operated in Israel, and you have to make a distinction between Israel and the West Bank, obviously, because that's Palestinian territory and under Palestinian rule. Ramallah, there should be no intrusion by anybody from either the Israeli government or the Defence Force, but they just ignore that now. They've already killed hundreds of people, Palestinians, in the West Bank. But it fits in exactly with what they did previously in May when they closed down Al Jazeera's operations in Israel. And it's to silence them. Because what the Israeli Defense Force and the Knesset argue is that Al Jazeera is a terrorist. This is crazy, but this is what they say. It's a terrorist organization. It supports Hamas, and therefore it should be shut down. Now, Al Jazeera is like the equivalent of the BBC. It seeks to tell the story. And the problem for the Israelis is that when you report from Gaza, you cannot avoid documenting all of the absolute carnage and destruction that's taken place there. What was an integrated civilization, economy, society has been devastated, so that now we have this awful situation where people have to be vaccinated against polio, something that's unheard of in most societies now. And so that's what it's about. The Israeli government, especially now, it's moved into extending its carnage and bombardment into the Lebanon. It wants to silence critical voices, both in closing them down and also, let's remember, two Al Jazeera journalists were assassinated in Gaza when they were reporting, and they were clearly wearing press vests. Their car was clearly marked, but it didn't matter. Their car was targeted. and they were killed. So it's both physically trying to prevent them from doing the job, and also in some cases murdering journalists as they do their job.
Well,
very simple.
Yeah, the figures are around about 170 media workers, I think, now have been killed. I mean, some people will say... What's your opinion? Some people are saying that actually this is specific, deliberate, and the idea is to simply stop the world seeing what's going on in Gaza.
Well that's absolutely the case. For example, Western journalists are not allowed into Gaza. They're only allowed if the Israeli Defense Force lets them. So that a whole array of journalists who would want to report inside Gaza can't do it, and those who are in there, most of those who are reporting inside Gaza are Palestinian, or they are people from other countries, Arab countries, where they can speak and do the go around interview and also report, and they are the ones who have been targeted. It's a brutal death toll, and it is not that we cannot accept any explanation that there was accidental deaths. These are targeted ways to silence people and to prevent them reporting from inside Gaza. And I think the closure of Al Jazeera's office in the West Bank is part of doing that as they move into extending their military operation into Lebanon.
But that's a great point. I think Granville Williams there speaking to me from up north somewhere, not quite, I think it's Leeds, I think he's based in. His outlet is called, he produces it quarterly, I think it's quarterly. It's called Media North. Martin, that Granville, what Granville's saying there, I think at the end, it's part of the military operation, is the closing down of the Al Jazeera Bureau in the West Bank. So it's almost as if they're trying to do two things at the same time. They start slinging a load of bombs at Lebanon. At the same time, whilst you're looking over there, they're shutting down what's going on in the West Bank. It does make you wonder whether the idea is really to nobble the West Bank, that we're coming for the people of the West Bank next, to genocide them.
Well, they're already, doing that.
Very premeditated and planned.
Yes, and of course they have quite deliberately targeted Al Jazeera journalists, including with the Daddy's Home AI app, which means that they waited till they came home and they killed their families. And of course, this has an effect, you know. I mean, ultimately, the mainstream journalistic organisations don't want to send people into Gaza because they know they're going to be killed. And that means that the Israelis pretty much have a free hand to do what they want. And that's what's going on.
It's a good way of dissuading people in Gaza to become journalists too, isn't it?
That's right.
The idea, would you want to be a journalist? Oh, yeah, I'd love to be, because like 2 days you'll be doing that job and then you'll be blown to bits.
And that threat of Assange's case, you know, we talk about the chilling effect. Is it real? I mean, I might have told the story last time, but there was that girl. Did I tell you the girl about the balloon? I was buying balloons for Julian Assange.
Yeah.
And you know, she was going to be a journalist, and she was following Assange and Snowden. She changed her mind when she found out what they were doing to them. And who can blame her? You know, like, how many people have the guts to sit in that prison cell like Julian Assange? And face the prospect of being in a solitary confinement for life in the United States. It's terrifying. You'd have to be crazy to do the type of thing that Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange did. I do believe there are people that crazy. I would do it if I had the opportunity. But so it kind of proves that the strategy to control the truth will fail, in my opinion. Doesn't mean they're not going to try their darndest, and we must push back. And, you know, the first casualty of war is the truth, isn't it? As you say, it's sowing the seeds for the next thing. Always the way they do that. And, it just shows to me that the protecting the truth is the number one human right that we must retain. Because it's the right from which all others flow. You can't maintain any of your other rights if you lose your control to know what your elected officials are doing in your name with your taxes.
In less than a year in Israel, there have been more journalists killed than in the whole of World War I and World War II. It's quite obvious what's happening, that they're being specifically targeted. I was saying there to Granville, Martin, the idea here is that not only will people just not want to report anything themselves, that no one will want to go in and report because they know they'll be targeted and killed, and actually no information, no evidence of these war crimes will ever get on the record. That's the idea, isn't it? Not only just get out to the public, but nobody will be there. There will just be a load of dead bodies, and of course, dead bodies can't talk.
Well, that's right, and you know, it's pretty clear what they're doing, and you know, the world is watching, and they're still doing it, and we'll have to see how this is all going to end. But of course, these are very dangerous days that we're living through.
I will point out, though, speaking of crazy people, that are not going to be intimidated no matter what. Craig Murray, former UK ambassador, also a good friend of Julian Assange and journalist, he has just tweeted that he's planning to go to Gaza.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I find that ironic, because Craig said he's moving out of Britain because Britain is too oppressive, but he's going to Gaza.
Well, that's right.
Wow.
Yes. I mean,
he's a lovely guy.
They won't let him in.
To me, those people prove that.
Well, he might go through a tunnel, Martin.
Power will not win.
He might get in through a tunnel or something.
Too many
knows?
Crazy radicals.
Also, of course, one of the major forces in all of this, particularly because Rupert Murdoch has shares in this company, Genie Energy, which is oil concessions in the Golan Heights, is the Rupert Murdoch empire. And you haven't heard much about it this week. That's because there's been all sorts of attempts to keep the press out. But there is a massive row going on within the Murdoch family about who is going to take it over. I spoke to Granville about that too.
This is a story that's been played out as we speak in court in San Reno in the United States. There was an agreement, a trust agreement, so that when Murdoch dies, and remember he's 93, but I'm amazed that he's still absolutely in control of the operations, even though he said he stood down. But the key was there was a trust set up. And Murdoch's got six children, but four of them are in this trust. The two children that Murdoch had with Wendy Deng, will receive money when he dies, but they won't be part of the actual decision-making. And what Murdoch wanted to do, he's called it, ironically, Project Harmony, is he wants to write out Elizabeth Murdoch, James Murdoch and Prudence McLeod, his eldest daughter, because they're not on board politically. Only Lachlan holds on to the absolutely horrible right-wing toxic projects that Rupert Murdoch has set up, like Fox News. And Fox News, of course, epitomises this, what we've talked about earlier, trust and distrust in the media. Fox News is absolutely anti-journalism. It's a form of propaganda, which for many years shamelessly boosted Donald Trump. And people like James Murdoch became really, really uncomfortable and have moved away. Broken indeed, he's signed a letter along with a few 30 other big business leaders in the state supporting Kamala Harris. So the battle is on. Murdoch wants to cut out any influence from James, Elizabeth and Prudence and hand on the mantle of this right-wing, nasty, poisonous project to Lachlan Murdoch, who I understand is even more right-wing, if it's possible, than his father.
We haven't heard much reporting of it, though. Why is that?
Well, you can't. It's totally under wraps. I mean, interestingly enough, back in July, the New York Times got a copy of the sealed affidavit that what Murdoch wants to do is to sort of cut out the other parts of the family and leave Lachlan in sole charge. So it's all taken part and been discussed under wraps. There was an attempt to try and make it an open trial in court, and that was knocked on the head. So it's all speculative, but what I think is happening is that James Murdoch is the one who's the most intransigent against any sort of attempt to hand on the poisoned legacy to Lachlan Murdoch. He's the most adamant. People aren't so sure about Prudence and Elizabeth. And I understand there's been a lot of back-channel pressure, discussion with them to try and get them to move away from supporting James. Now, that's just speculation. Mm. That's all I'm just reading between the lines, because, as you said, it's not being reported. You get speculative stories about what's going on, that Prudence might be trying to mediate between them, and then another one might have a story saying that Elizabeth Murdoch might be trying to mediate between them. But we don't know. This information isn't coming out. Everybody's keeping stum about it.
So apologies for the sound quality with the interview with Granville Williams there, the editor of Media North. And then the full version of that, and I'll put some links up on our show page to his Media North websites and stuff where you can just sign up. He'll email you something once every 3 months or something, keeping you up to date with what's going on in the ownership of, popularity of, and that's what Granville used to do. He used to do this map every 2 or 3 years of who owns the media in Britain. And I think that's now just being done by the Press Gazette, funded by somebody else. But anyway, at least there are still these things around about who is actually controlling what we see and hear. This media empire, Martin, the media empire is of Rupert Murdoch is a massive pawn in the international game. Well, it's not a pawn. It's probably at least a bishop or a queen or something.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and Murdoch makes no secret of his extremely, you know, his extreme views. I mean, he's very pro-Israeli, for example. He's very much in favour of the annexation of the Golan Heights, which has been accepted by
funnily
the Americans.
Funnily enough, since yeah, he's got an financial
investment. That's right, because there's actually a load of oil under the Golan Heights, and he's a shareholder in Genie Energy.
But it's a bit weird, this whole thing of a probate case. You'd think that would happen maybe after he died, but it's before he's died. He's now got, it's actually the three other Murdoch children, James, Elizabeth and Prudence, have taken their own father to court and challenged his will, saying, hang on, this is not right. So that's what this is about. It's all very secret, and apparently in the next few weeks there will be an announcement of some sort, but they've kept it completely, as much as they possibly can, under wraps. Does it matter?
Well, of course it matters, because these people are powerful. It's like the Medici, you know, it really matters who's going to take over the family business.
I mean, the intelligence services will have an interest in this, won't they?
They will, yeah. And the Israeli government will definitely want, you know,
Their person to take it over.
That's right. They don't want people who are going to start asking them nasty questions.
Hey, how about us three? Maybe we should take it over.
That'd be brilliant. Come on.
Be fun, wouldn't it? What a party. Yeah.
Might not be put, it'd be a lot better. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
One thing I find fascinating about Murdoch is that he's like the yin and yang. He's Australian. Like Assange is like the opposite, isn't he? He's sort of information for the people. Decide for yourselves. Here's the truth. And Murdoch's the opposite. And they're both Australian. It's something that really blows my mind. Yeah. Mm. It's sort of quite peculiar.
Is it called Sky Australia? Seems to me much better than a lot of the other outlets he's got. Anyway, yeah, we're going to have our break now. We're going to come back after the break to talk about the, well, we're going to, also going to ask Matt about, this campaign to pardon Assange, as well as, picking up on what's been going on at the UN Security Council and, of course, on the ground in Lebanon.
Christ is the الجنوب لكي يقاوم إن تاريخ الإباء غير نائم يكتب عن أرضنا أرض الملاحم عاب مجدك بالمذلة والهزائم
Yeah, enjoy yourself, folks. It's later than you think. I think it's very appropriate for the Armageddon being threatened in the second hour. So that's the specials. Before that, we heard from a lady from Lebanon. She's massively famous in Lebanon. We don't hear anything of her here. Her name is Julia Boutros. That song is Mukawern for Palestine, which is a recent song, something to do with supporting the Palestinians. The Lebanese do, of course, and everyone else sensible in the world does. Mm. As well as before that, we had Fight the Good Fight from the choir of Guildford Cathedral. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, me, Tony Gosling, and Kiwi activist living here in Bristol, Matt O'Brannan. To begin with, let's have a look at this threat from Vladimir Putin this week. He's saying very clearly, if you want to mess about, ladies and gentlemen, you will no doubt be getting a nuclear weapon coming your way. In fact, we won't necessarily tell you which we will, but we are, because you've been poking the bear so much, we've decided we're going to change our nuclear doctrine. And that nuclear doctrine means that if we think that you're attacking the Russian homeland and trying to threaten the existence of Russia, we will nuke you. This is quite a serious move, Martin, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what the implications of this are, because it's always been Russian doctrine that they will never use nuclear weapons in a first strike, that they only have them as literally a second strike insurance policy.
I mean, last week we reported that Keir Starmer wanted to secretly allow the Ukrainians to use these long-range weapons to strike all over Russia.
Well, what makes me extremely angry is that Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of Britain, has been going around prodding the Americans, saying, we want to fire missiles into Russia. Can we? And it's the Americans and the Pentagon who are saying, well, no, because they'll fire back. And it's just extraordinary that a Labour Prime Minister should think it's his job to persuade the Americans, so that what could happen is that we finally did get, and of course, Sir Ed Davey and Boris Johnson and all these other great and good are saying Britain should fire missiles into Russia. Whether the Americans agree or not, we should take a lead here. Now, that actually sets Britain up to be the target of Russian retaliation.
Well, the Americans are saying this, surely, mainly because they think that the Russians might hit them if the British do it.
I understand from the reading,
it's
the Pentagon, the military people, who are saying, we're not doing this. Because they know very well that if the Russians fire back, they're going to be able to create a huge amount of damage.
Well, it just shows they might have a tiny, teeny, teeny bit of sense in the end. But it is shocking, as you say, that we've got Keir Starmer, head of a supposed left party.
Yep.
You know, I've been saying this to people. Keir Starmer is the most vicious, duplicitous UK politician I've ever seen in my lifetime, and I'm counting Thatcher and Tony Blair into that.
Yep.
He was the guy, head of the CPS, going after Assange. And
Crown Prosecution Service.
That's right.
Yeah, the utterly useless Crown Prosecution Service.
And I went to a FOIA hearing for Stefania Maurizi. She's trying to dig up metadata. She's trying to find a smoking gun that Keir Starmer might have been involved in the destruction of documents on the clear collaboration between the UK, Sweden and the United States to get their hands on Assange, while pretending it was all about some Swedish sexual assault investigation, which it wasn't. And he was secretly flying to Washington, during that time, four trips funded by the taxpayer, secret trips. We're electing this guy, to be, Prime Minister. Meanwhile, he's also a human rights lawyer who's saying that, he believes that Israel has the right to cut off food and water to the entire population. He said this on television. This is the guy, that we've elected as Prime Minister. And he's, you know, he showed up in Washington. I don't know if you saw him with his red briefcase coming off the plane, looking all, you know, excited. And they knocked him back and said, no, you're crazy. It's just like, this guy's completely
dangerous.
Sorry, who
knocked him back?
The Pentagon. And he came back from that and they said, no, we're not going to approve this. And Putin quite rightly pointed out, very, you know, he said that it's not that NATO are going to allow Israel to use these weapons. Putin said
Ukraine.
These He said that, it's actually, Ukraine cannot actually do it themselves. He said that the targeting systems that they use must actually be controlled by a NATO country. So this whole idea that they're going to allow Ukraine to use them is actually a fallacy. It would actually be a NATO country that would have to put in the coordinates and push the button.
So this is similar, actually, to the Trident nuclear submarines, isn't it? Because they're all American-built, American-designed. The British say they've got an independent nuclear deterrent. We don't, really, because all of these devices are all US-controlled, ultimately. So if the US decides they don't want the Brits to fire it, then the Brits won't fire it. It's that simple. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Putin. What did he actually say? It's rather annoyed me about the coverage this week, that we keep getting sort of live coverage of Netanyahu speaking at the UN. We haven't had any live coverage of, say, Russia speaking at the UN or Putin speaking and saying, look, guys, if you let your leaders attack us, we're going to start using, we're going to start attacking you. We may not use nukes initially, but we reserve the right to use them against you. We don't want to. We really don't. So please try and stop your leaders attacking us. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Putin and his words this week.
The updated version of the document proposes that aggression against Russia by any non-nuclear weapon state, but with the participation or support of a nuclear weapon state, should be regarded as a joint attack on the Russian Federation. The conditions for Russia's transition to the use of nuclear weapons are also clearly defined. We will consider such a possibility as soon as we receive reliable information about a massive launch of aerospace attack means and their crossing of our state border, meaning strategic or tactical aircraft, cruise missiles, drones, hypersonic missiles, and other aircraft. We reserve the right to use nuclear weapons in the event of aggression against Russia and Belarus as a member of the Union State. All these issues have been agreed upon with the Belarusian side and with the President of Belarus. This includes cases when the enemy, using conventional weapons, poses a critical threat to our sovereignty.
So I think it's fair to say, Martin, that actually our very own Sir Keir Starmer has provoked this.
Yeah, I think what Putin is saying there, from what I'm just, I was listening quite carefully. The problem with, in the past, you could separate nuclear weapons from conventional weapons. So in theory, you could have a conventional war, which both sides agree that we're not going to use nuclear weapons, so we can shoot at each other, but the nuclear weapons will stay in the silos, we're not going to use
them. That's very much the Kissinger doctrine, where he was making a massive difference between, operating against and attacking nuclear states and non-nuclear states. He said just don't even go there when it comes to nuclear states. The United States has got to avoid that and at all costs.
Yeah, but I mean,
because he's dead now. He died last year.
Yes, but at one stage we were moving towards a situation where both the US and the Russian Federation had long-range nuclear missiles which they could fire at each other if it came down to it. But because and then all the shorter range stuff, the intermediate range missiles were banned. That's exactly why Greenham Common was closed down. It was one of the victories. We don't get many victories, but that was a victory.
Huge.
We're going to get rid of all of these low-level nukes, and of course what we then do is only big countries can have intercontinental ballistic missiles, and there's less room for error there. Yeah, because it takes at least half an hour for one of these missiles to fire and reach its target. Whereas, of course, what the NATO has now done, they've put missiles in Poland, in Romania, and they're planning to put them in Germany, and that leaves the Russian side with perhaps 2 minutes to decide whether they're under a nuclear attack or not. And of course, any missile that crosses your border could have a nuclear warhead on it. So when the British Storm Shadow missile fires, the Russians have got to presume that it might have a tactical nuke on it. And in that case, they've got to move to nuclear response. And that's why we shouldn't do this. I mean, in the 1980s, there was fighting going on between the Syrians and the Israelis. And the Russians had their people in embedded with the Syrians, and both sides had to back off. They didn't, because if it came to fighting between the Russians and the Israelis, you could easily imagine it could go nuclear quite quickly. Now, people used to understand why it was necessary not to have confrontations between nuclear states. So it's all done by proxy. Yeah, we're going to fight in Angola with, you're going to support UNITA, we're going to support the MPLA, but it's not going to be direct fighting between your troops and our troops. Mm. Even though the Cuban army came in and defeated the South Africans at Kita Kinabalu in southern Angola, but there was no suggestion that nuclear weapons would be used. The problem with all of these, the kit that's now used, the F-16s and all the rest of it, they're all nuclear capable. So if they fire a rocket, which could be a conventional missile, it could be a nuclear missile. And if you get that wrong, and they hit you with that missile while you think it's a conventional missile, then you can lose. You know, they can do decapitation strikes. This is why the Americans wouldn't accept nuclear missiles in Cuba, because it's too close. You can't just put that stuff in our face. And the Russians have been saying this all along. You can't just push this stuff in our face, because it's right in our face. You've got to take it away.
The margin for error is too short, isn't it? As you say, 2 minutes to decide to determine.
Yeah, and in that case, you've got to put everything on a hair trigger. Mm. And, of course, we've come very close to nuclear war several times. In 1983, the only thing that stopped us having a nuclear war was that the Russian guy in charge of deciding to press the button decided not to follow his standing orders and didn't press the button, and what turned out to be a flock of swans didn't cause nuclear war, but it might have done. And there's several when the history book comes to be written in the 23rd century or whatever, it'll be quite clear that we came close to nuclear war several times, more than once. And so people have just got so used to this, they just presume that it's not going to happen.
Martin, we've just heard from Putin over in Moscow. How about, let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer, as he was talking about earlier in his speech to the Labour Party. He said, I'm off to... actually, maybe we should hear that first, because he made that amazing blunder, didn't he, this week? Did you hear that? About the sausages?
Yeah. We've got to release the sausages.
Is that what he said?
He said hostages.
I heard it. Yeah, I wasn't quite sure.
Well, let's have a listen to a little bit, anyway, of Keir Starmer's massive speech. I mean, it's incredibly tedious, folks. Don't worry. We're not going to play more than about 3 minutes of it. But here he is. There's lots and lots of stuff about change. I mean, I honestly do think, and I noticed one of the national newspapers saying the same. I think it might have been The Telegraph, saying, are these speeches now generated by AI? Anyway, you see if you can make your own mind up about, and listen out towards the end, about the sausages in Gaza.
Our economy stabilised, the foundations of this country fixed, Tory rot cleared away. So brick by brick, we can build a new home, a better home, built to last, built with pride, but above all built together. A nation rebalanced so that it once again serves the interests of working people. And through the power unleashed by that process, a renewal of who we are. A country that gives equal voice to every person. A country that won't expect you to change who you are just to get on. A country that doesn't just work for you and your family, but one that recognises you, that sees you and respects you as part of our story. A Britain that belongs to you. Because make no mistake, that is the Britain we are building. Change isn't a few lines on a graph moving in the right direction. Change isn't a good Labour policy or two delivered, while the broader settlement remains untouched. No, change must mean nothing less than national renewal. Not a return to the old ways, nor a new path entirely, but a rediscovery in the full glare of the future of who we are. The trouble is, conference, just as we found with the Labour Party 4 years ago, Britain is no longer sure of itself. Our story is uncertain. The hope beaten out of us. There's pride, of course there is. Pride in our communities, especially. And there's respect too, all around the world. Trust me, nobody anywhere doubts that this is a great nation. A nation known for our creativity, our artistic skill, our scientific genius, and of course, our pragmatism. Quality that, combined with the industry and pride of working people, have not just rewritten our own story, but also that of the world. We could do that again. In fact, we must. Technology, climate change, the aging population, the movement of people. This is a time when great forces demand a decisive government prepared to face the future. We can see that again in the Middle East today. So I call again for restraint and de-escalation at the border between Lebanon and Israel. Again, all parties to pull back from the brink. I call again for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, the return of the sausages, the hostages, and a recommitment to the two-state solution. A recognized Palestinian state alongside a safe and secure Israel. And that's the message I will take to the UN General Assembly when I travel there later today.
Yes, yeah, so the release of the sausages, followed by a massive round of applause. Oh, the hostages. Yeah, this is going to go down in history, Martin, in a way, isn't it? It's just the most unbelievable thing to mistake to make. But also, you see what I mean about the AI-generated stuff? I mean, he's talking about Britain's story. He's even being so bizarre as to say, well, Britain was great, we can make it great again. Well, is he saying we're going to have another empire? What on earth is he on about?
It's kind of psycho drivel, isn't it? There's no politics in that. Mm. That's just a sort of the sort of speech you get from HR in Amazon, isn't it? You know, mm. We're going to motivate we're going to reach our sales targets, and you know, where's the politics in that? Nothing. It's just it's just empty words.
Empty rhetoric.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let's have a listen. You just while we were listening to that, Matt, you were saying it sounded like Kamala. So let's have a listen to Kamala.
That's right.
Maybe we can compare and contrast Kamala Harris, who's standing for the U.S. presidency for the Democratic Party in the United States this year.
Yeah.
We are an optimistic people. We are an optimistic people. Americans, by character, are people who have dreams and ambitions and aspirations. We believe in what is possible. We believe in what can be. And we believe in fighting for that. That's how we came into being. Because the people before us understood that one of the greatest expressions for the love of our country, one of the greatest expressions of patriotism, is to fight for the ideals of who we are.
Okay, so can we compare that to... Do you think that's the sort of the way that the left wing in the United States and Britain, Martin, is now sort of pitching itself?
Well, I think it's a bit of a stretch to call either of them left wing, is what I would say.
Right, like traditionally left wing.
What we've got there is the triumph of style over substance, yeah?
Mm.
There is no politics in either of those little clips we've heard there.
Yeah.
There's nothing about the redistribution of power. There's nothing about, any of the challenges that we faced, nuclear war, banking collapse. I'd put those at the top of the list.
Cost of living.
And, the cost of living crisis is caused because we caused a war with the with the Russians. Mm-hmm. And then the Americans, our allies, blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is going to put the European economy into depression for at least a generation. And it wasn't the Russians who did that. That was our American friends, which we are so friendly with, that they can do things like that to us. And
we even
tell them thanks very much.
In the States.
Didn't Theresa May send a text, "It's done," as well, just after it?
Yeah,
so they were involved.
She quite definitely
knew about
did.
It,
yeah, well, she certainly knew. Yeah. So, you've got this weird situation in the States where there aren't any proper presidential debates anymore. There's these kind of talk show hosts sitting and chatting with Kamala Harris. And there she's saying, actually, it's our The Americans are dreamers. They just want everything to work. So why are Americans sending all this money and weapons to kill kids in Gaza? Is that because this is because they want everyone to get along together, and this is part of the dream? That it's not, is it? So there's actually no reality to this, none at all. And I was very pleased someone sent me this little clip from Radio New Zealand, which I think is rather nice. So we're going to have a listen, if I can find it, to that now. This whole, Martin, could you just say something while I'm finding the clip about this whole idea that it's no longer, reality doesn't even feature in here?
Well, I think what's happening is that because in actual fact politicians don't have much power, they basically do what they're told by the big boys who we all know who they are, once we've looked into it, they get absolutely obsessed with presentation, as if that's why he took the money for the suits and these designer glasses, which cost thousands of pounds. What's he going to do with these designer glasses? Every time he turns up at any meeting with those glasses on, the first thing people are going to say, oh, those are those glasses, he's wearing them. Now, if he could put them in the drawer and not wear them, but then they've now become, symbolic of his
ministership. What you said about HR is absolutely spot on. This is public relations, it's not politics.
That's what it is, and it's when you think back, say Harold Wilson talking about the white heat of technology, and also saying that we're getting away from the Grouse-Moore theory of running the country. We're going to get people who have actually got some idea what to do, and we're going to make things fairer for people. And people could take this on board. It was a pitch, and there was some political. Some political meat in it. This stuff really is just rhetoric about feeling good. We need to feel better about ourselves. Yeah, that's the real thing.
The creepy thing about it is all these policies are leading to worse and worse conditions for everybody, and yet we're supposed to be smiling about it.
Well, that's right. I mean, in actual fact, the economy, we're going to have the budget coming up in October. And of course, the economy in Britain is flatlining, and economies don't flatline for long, especially if you start cutting public expenditure, they start to go down.
Well, what Rachel
Reeves
is going to do.
And then, of course, the situation just gets worse and worse.
Well, what Rachel Reeves is going to do is she's going to be taking people's houses off them. That's what she'll be doing.
Well, what will probably happen...
I mean, you've had your cars super taxed, so you can only just about afford to get to work in them. And now they're going to take your house too.
Well, they're not going to take... What's going to happen is the cost of housing has been rising through the roof. I mean, my rent has risen twice in the last 2 years. And, of course, the mortgage... what will happen probably if the economy starts to go down is that interest rates will come down. So that should give people who are on mortgages buying their houses a bit of a relief. But the problem is they're going to lose their jobs, so they won't be able to pay the mortgage anyway.
Let's go back to this clip from Radio New Zealand this week. The guy's name is Jonathan Taplin, and his book is about how four billionaires are selling us a fantasy. So this is part. I guess this is what Starmer and Harris are part of.
I'm talking to Jonathan Taplin. If you've just joined us, his book is called The End of Reality, How Four Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future. And central to the ideas of your book, Jonathan, is this idea of techno-determinism. Can you explain that concept to us?
Yeah. So the idea is that since the beginning of the commercial internet, so let's say the time when Google goes public in 2007. This idea of the internet was supposed to be this great democratizing force. And I'm old enough to have met a lot of the people that created the internet, people like Vint Cerf, and they really did believe that they were building a kind of new democracy. And they believed it so much that all the protocols that we use, HTTP, HTML, they invented and gave to the public for free. They don't get any royalties on it or anything. But once the internet got captured by commercial forces, then there was a kind of monopoly situation of which we have never seen since John D. Rockefeller had monopolized the oil business. So Google has 90% market share in search. Facebook has about 78% of all search traffic, that is between Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, all those things. So you would think that there would be government regulation, but because the technologists have kind of intimidated politicians to the extent that they think they know what they're doing and we, the public, should just follow their plan for the internet, and obviously it's coming to artificial intelligence in an exact same way, there can be no regulation because politicians don't know what they're doing, and we should just leave it to the billionaire overlords to determine what technology policy. And so there has never been any regulation of social networks, even though it's been proven by many people that teenage suicides, self-harm, all those were started skyrocketing as soon as Facebook got to 2 billion users. And so the notion of techno-determinism is, hey, shut up and just let us drive the car, like Mark Andreessen or Elon Musk. And look, it's coming in lots of other ways. Why do you think Elon Musk and Mark Andreessen and Peter Thiel are investing in Donald Trump's campaign? Because they figure that if he gets in, they will take over the military-industrial complex. They, you know, SpaceX will replace Boeing. Palantir will replace any other data company. Anduril, which is Mark Andreessen's drone manufacturing company, will replace Raytheon. And it's just a classic old, good old Robber Baron thing, only in digital clothing.
What does the fight back look like, Jonathan? What does the rebellion look like?
Well, it takes two parts, one of which is in our country, we have a young woman who is chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, Lina Khan, who has sued Google, who has sued Facebook, and has sued Amazon to break them up. So that's the beginning of the fight. And the second part of the fight is personal stuff. Every single person I know who's built these social media tools, does not let their child take their phone into their bedroom at night. They know how dangerous it is. And they know that a lot of the bullying, a lot of the bad stuff goes on in kids' bedrooms at night. And in California, we just passed a law that was signed yesterday by the governor. It says nobody can have a phone on in school during the day. So that's the beginning of the fight. It's to restrict the usage of these harmful technologies and maybe to break up these companies.
There you go. That's Jonathan Taplin. His rather wonderful book, which I'd not come across before, even though it's been out for a year or so, that is called The End of Reality, How 4 Billionaires Are Selling Out Our Future. Now, this whole idea of techno-determinism, love it. This is exactly what they're doing. Great terminology, never heard that before, but he's talking about the Mark Andreessen, who is, I mean, he's not famous for this company, Anduril, but it's Anduril Capital. He's been sort of tapped up and given loads of money by Peter Thiel, and off he goes. And you know what? This is very similar, Martin, to what Whitney Webb has been talking about. This is a similar kind of, he's coming at it from a much more of a kind of mainstream point of view, but he's coming to the same conclusion, is these people are essentially corporate robber barons. And he said it himself there, the robber barons. There's no democracy anywhere in any of this. Of course, it's a kind of fascist robber baron system that they're bringing in.
Well, I mean, they've kind of recreated a techno version of the 19th century, haven't they? The Gilded Age, where the wealthy just called all the shots and everybody else just had to suck up whatever they dished out to them.
Well, and, Putin doesn't seem to want to.
Well, no, but that's the problem for them, is that in other parts of the world, people have wised up to this. I mean, when I first went to Russia, that wasn't the first time I went to Russia in the 1970s, but when I went back in the 1990s, I was in St. Petersburg on the day when they voted to change the name from Leningrad to St. Petersburg. So they had a referendum on it. And at the same time, all the people I was spoken to, they'd all voted for Yeltsin. And I said to them, well, what about Gorbachev? And they were just scoffing, you know, he's just a silly old communist. We just want to live like you. We want the same kind
of
thing.
Well, the West did a good job, didn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, what's happened now, of course, those same people, many years later, and their kids have decided that they don't want to live like the West at all. In fact, they've experienced it, they've been there, done it, and got the T-shirt, and they've had enough of it.
Well, it's not just that, is it? The West, Martin, the West is not what it was. It's a very much a shadow of its former self.
Well,
in terms of quality of life, and in terms of disposable income, that we're nowhere near where we were 30 years ago.
Well, yes, that's true. But, of course, in the 1990s, we were still pushing this line. I mean, I remember coming back from Russia and going to speak to somebody from the British government. He was actually working in the Foreign Office. He's only a lowly guy. And I went to his office and I was saying, well, why are they doing this? What are they doing? What they're doing to the Russians is just idiotic. They're going to destroy the economy doing what they're doing. And why are they doing it? Are they doing it because they believe all this free market drivel? You know, we've tried it in this country and it was disastrous. Why do they imagine it's going to work in Russia? Or is the really more sinister thing, they're trying to destroy their industries so that they can never create a military threat to the West ever again?
Ah.
And this guy said to me, it's both those things that you suggested. And a third thing, which you haven't mentioned, is some people making an awful lot of money out of this. And of course,
but the motivation is geopolitical. It's not really money, is it? That's motivating the individuals, but the overall plan is a geopolitical one.
Well, it's a geopolitical plan to steal resources. Yeah.
Well, and to nobble and disable
Siberia
countries.
Is a massive gold mine. Yeah. And, you know, it's a gold mine, it's a uranium mine, every possible resource, rare earths, it's all in Siberia. And what they were hoping is if we can get a pro-Western government in Moscow, Western multinationals and all of these other people will go in there
It's also the outlook and the morals of the people who are on that land. Those are what they're trying to overturn too. Before we go too deep into that, you've had your say there, Martin. Yeah. Let's have a listen to, because one of the things I've noticed with this Labour Party conference is there are several protesters have been popping up, and I love these people that they're just sitting there in the audience, and I as a Quaker, that's how the Quakers started. You stand up in the middle of the sermon and you say, excuse me, Mr. Priest, or whoever you happen to be, vicar, I don't agree with that, and that's what they're doing in the Labour Party conference. So the question is, what was the guy on about who interrupted Keir Starmer's conference? And he was interviewed outside afterwards.
I hadn't planned on saying anything. It's just when I heard him speak about how he wants these fine bombs in Lebanon, just the hypocrisy on how every day we're still sending British bombs and British bullets that are being used in Lebanon and in Gaza right now. And the Prime Minister, he could stop that. He could stop that right now, but he doesn't. And he says that he wants things to stop, but he won't lift a finger to actually stop them.
So you weren't planning on saying anything, you were just moved to say why?
No, I was a delegate, I'm a Labour Party member. I'd hoped I'd be one for life, but I suspect not now. But just what's happened and just the complete failure of the Labour Party and Keir Starmer to address it, it's just completely sickening.
What more specifically do you want from them?
I have complete suspension of arms sales to Israel. Embargoes, sanctions, whatever it takes to stop this genocide that is currently occurring, not just empty platitudes to conference halls full of people who support you.
Can I ask what your job is, or are you a student?
I'm a student.
Are you happy with Keir Starmer as Labour leader?
Absolutely not, no. Although it's not just him, it's the party more general and the wider political establishment for not being supportive of taking the action that is required in order to stop this genocide and actually stop the war like they claim they want to do.
Can you tell us what was going through your head as you were sat there and what sort of was the moment you decided to stand up and start talking?
I was just angry. I mean, myself, I guess, for not saying anything at the time. But again, like I say, just for him coming out to say that he wanted a ceasefire, but not taking any of the actions that he could, not lifting a finger in order to do it. And I was just angry, and
in the end, I decided I had to do it before the speech was over.
How many? Sorry,
Don. I don't know if you heard what Keir Starmer said back at you.
No, no.
He said you must have a pass from 2019, and they've changed the Labour Party. What do you make of
that? No, I joined in 2022 when he was leader. I thought he would be able to do what he said to be a more moderate force that could win the election and still deliver change, but he hasn't delivered change. We've got the same Tory corruption sleaze with all of this stuff about free clothes and free spectacles and free Taylor Swift concert tickets. No, I'm not. I've never been a member of the Labour Party under Corbyn.
Do you think other Labour members should be taking a harder line on Gaza and putting more pressure on
Keir? I think so, yeah. I mean, I understand that people aren't comfortable in doing what I did. But I think that there needs to be more vocal line from the party saying, or from the party members saying, no, we can't stand for this. If you really are for a ceasefire, you need to take the steps that are required to make that happen.
And can I just ask, what did you actually say when you stood up? Because it was quite difficult to catch it on.
Yes. I mean, I'm not really sure myself, to be honest. Just about saying that while he was talking about providing opportunities for children in Gaza and children in Lebanon are having British bombs and bullets rain down on them because he won't lift a finger to stop them.
He won't lift a finger to actually stop them. That was Daniel Riley. Do you want to guess his age? Bless him.
19.
25.
18. 18 years old.
Bliss.
And, of course, Starmer's so-called witty quip was just rubbish. As you might expect, because he wasn't actually even in the Labour Party back in 2019. So he's trying to sort of blame Jeremy Corbyn, Martin, for someone who's pointing out that his words are just empty rhetoric and he's actually complicit with war crimes and genocide.
Yeah, well, as you know, Tony Blair eventually blotted his copybook amongst, right-thinking people with the war in Iraq, but it took quite a while for people to see through him. I think Starmer's problem is he started off with this albatross round his neck, and he's going to be remembered as the war prime minister who lost the war in Ukraine and allowed a genocide in Gaza, and that is going to be his epitaph. That's what he'll be remembered for historically.
Well, yes. I mean, it seems to me also the way politics and the military operations, the forever wars work now, is they try to get each person to start one, although Trump doesn't seem to want to. We'll be getting to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But, well, we'll see. Maybe he will, Martin. Martin's sort of ha-ha-ha. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, but he's, there is a difference here.
He assassinated General Soleimani, which nearly caused World War III.
Yeah, but only it didn't. No, it didn't.
Because
no,
the Iranians showed restraint,
no,
not because
didn't.
He showed
no,
restraint.
No, it didn't nearly start World War III. It's just a ridiculous exaggeration.
That's not true, Tony.
Even if Trump had been assassinated by somebody, that wouldn't
have started
World War III.
Well, they're now saying that Trump is being... They're now claiming that the Iranians are trying to assassinate Trump and Trump's going along with it.
Well,
saying that
he's
going to pulverise Iran. That's what he says he's going to do, Tony.
Well, I'm not... I'm
if
not,
people vote for
I'm
him.
Not, yes,
he says
there's
going to be a war with Iran.
All right.
That's what he says. He's already said that yesterday.
But we have seen... there are all sorts of... Maybe the idea is to get various wars going like they have in Gaza and keep them going until Trump goes in so he can say, I didn't start this. Maybe that's just as simple as that. It's silliness. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer as he went jetted across the Atlantic in his, of course, the organic fuel green powered plane in order to speak to the United Nations Security Council. I think he said, what did he say he was going to do? He was going to call in for peace over there?
We must ensure accountability for those violating the UN Charter. And this Council must recommit to the values it sets out. Now, this should go without saying. Yet the greatest violation of the Charter in a generation has been committed by one of this Council's permanent members. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is illegal. It threatens global security. It's caused colossal human suffering. Over 35,000 civilians have been killed or injured, 6 million forced to flee, and almost 20,000 Ukrainian children forcefully deported, kidnapped, to put it bluntly. I think of Yaroslav Bazilovich, whose wife and three daughters were killed earlier this month by a Russian strike on civilians in Lviv. And I wonder how Russia can show its face in this building. 600,000 Russian soldiers have been killed or wounded in this war. And for what? The UN Charter, which they sit here to uphold, speaks of human dignity, not treating your own citizens as bits of meat to fling into the grinder. Russia's war has triggered a global energy crisis and a global food crisis, causing hunger in the Horn of Africa. They entered into a UN-brokered Black Sea grain deal, then withdrew. They tried to block the pact for the future. Now the world looks on as Russia deepens its military ties with the likes of North Korea and Iran. There can be no equivocation here. They must be held accountable. Aggression cannot pay. Borders cannot be redrawn by force. Russia started this illegal war. It must end it and get out of Ukraine. We stand with the 89 countries who made clear at the Swiss Peace Summit that Ukraine's territorial integrity must be the basis of any just and lasting peace. Any process that does not recognize this will only be used as a pretext by Russia to regroup and come again.
Actually, part of that speech, Martin, Starmer's saying, how can Russia show its face here? He's also accusing the Russians of the greatest violation, the greatest illegal war. I mean, he's almost implying ever here. But he's not talking about the genocide in Gaza at all. He's almost all focusing on... He didn't really quite do what he said he'd do at his party conference speech, did he, when he was at the UN?
No, and of course... Britain and the US invaded Iraq, even though Germany and France, who are members of the security, Germany isn't, the French are, refused to go along with it.
So you think it's legal for Russia to invade Ukraine, do you?
It depends what you mean by legal. Was it legal for us to go to war to make Kosovo independent of Serbia?
No, Martin, you're talking, you've started off talking about Kosovo there. You're also talking about other conflicts like Iraq. Let's talk about Ukraine.
Let's talk about Ukraine.
Ukraine?
The oblasts in Ukraine in 2014, the Donbass and Luhansk, they had a referendum where they voted to leave the Ukraine, just like the American colonists had a congress in 1776 to leave the British Empire. It was illegal. They didn't want to. The British said, that's illegal. You can't just leave the British Empire. The rules say you've got to work through the system if you want to leave, and we're not going to let you go. And so we went to war. And of course, the whole American Revolution was against British legality. The people in the Donbass and in Luhansk voted to leave the Ukraine because they're not Ukrainians.
I mean, one thing
they're
has
Russian.
Happened this
They'd
week.
Always been thought of themselves as Russians. They're only in Ukraine under sufferance.
So this week.
And once people started killing them, which is what they did, they rose up and they fought back. The Ukrainian army split. Yeah, we heard
well, we
this
were
last
hearing
week.
All about that last
yes.
week. Yeah,
yeah.
Leon Panetta is a former director of the CIA. This week, he's been saying that the Israelis' attack using pagers is actually a terrorist attack. Now, he's a former CIA guy. I mean, a lot of the Americans. I mean, surely there's a reducing number of people who are prepared to defend these kinds of illegal genocidal actions by Israel.
Again, it's like you've got Kissinger and Leon Panetta suddenly being the voices of reason. That's when you know we're in deep, dark waters, you know.
So let's have a listen now to the Russians, the people you don't hear from very often at the UN, talking about what they say is what's really going on. Because we had a UN Security... It's a little bit confusing. We had a UN Security Council meeting closely followed, which I think the Russians were really annoyed because Zelensky was allowed to speak there. And, of course, they're not... they're not permanent members, nor any other kind of members of the UN
Zelensky
Security
isn't
Council.
Even elected anymore.
Well, correct. Yeah, so the Russians made lots of points about this, saying, well, what is this guy even doing in the room? And I think it's the Slovak Republic that's now, at the moment, chair of the UN Security Council. But anyway, let's have a listen to what the Russians have to say.
Mr. President, in the chants of Western countries, Ukraine is presented as an innocent victim of Russian aggression, and the United States and its allies are presented as peacekeepers. Nothing could be further from the truth than statements like this. Under the neo-Nazi regime in Kiev, Ukraine has become a dictatorship of one man, ready to not only drown the whole country in blood and sacrifice all young Ukrainians who did not have time to flee the country, but also to push the world into the abyss of a third world war for the sake of preserving his power and blindly playing along with the West. Although a few years ago, Vladimir Zelensky said the following, "I can assure you that I am ready for anything to prevent our heroes from dying anymore, and I'm definitely not afraid to make difficult decisions. I am ready to lose my post without hesitation so that peace can only come." Now these phrases seem to be something from the realm of fantasy. They have lost so much relevance. In the conditions of an extremely low level of support for him by the population, he experiences an animal fear of losing power, because he understands that he will face retribution for all the crimes that he committed while in office. Let me remind you that the next elections were supposed to be held on March 31, but Volodymyr Zelensky canceled them under the pretext of martial law, which contradicts the basic law of the country. After May 20 of this year, when, according to the Constitution, presidential powers should have passed to the Speaker of the Verkhovna Rada, the leader of the Kiev junta turned into a banal usurper of power. By the way, on August 28, the powers of the Ninth Convocation of the Rada expired. In the 5 years of his presidential term, he led the country entrusted to him to the abyss by selling Ukraine off to Western corporations, destroying its economy, and plunging it into a deep demographic crisis. President Biden spoke today about the need to save the Ukrainian nation. "Nothing threatens the Ukrainian nation. We are not fighting her. We are fighting a criminal regime that has seized power in Kiev and is leading its people to disaster. And this is not a war for territories, as our enemies claim. This is a battle for the consciousness and rights of people." Mr. President, a just and sustainable settlement of the Ukrainian crisis is impossible without addressing its root causes. First of all, the elimination of violations of the rights of the Russian-speaking population and the abolition of other discriminatory laws in Ukraine. Today, we hear calls from different sides for a political and diplomatic solution based on the UN Charter. However, no settlement will be possible in accordance with Article 1.3 of the Charter without overcoming the legacy of the Maidan, eradicating nationalism, Nessism, and other manifestations of discrimination in Ukraine, respecting the rights and fundamental freedoms for all, without distinction as to race, sex, language, and religion. We have not heard about this seemingly obvious conclusion either from our Western colleagues or from the UN Secretary General. Nor have we heard another important thesis, namely that the purposes and principles of the Charter must be respected in their entirety, and in their interrelation. In addition to the provisions on respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, it also contains the principle of self-determination of peoples. This should not be forgotten in any case, as well as the responsibility of governments for all citizens of their states without exception. We hope that the Kiev regime will not be able to completely destroy its country and its people, which it is already close to, nor push our world into the abyss of a nuclear catastrophe. To do this, it should adopt realistic parameters for a long-term settlement of the Ukrainian crisis as soon as possible, and not slide into some unrealistic ultimatums, plans for victory, etc. As for us, Russia has always been ready to live in peace and good neighborliness with Ukraine until it was turned into an aggressive, Russophobic neo-Nazi hornet's nest that threatens our security, and began to make plans to draw it into the militaristic NATO bloc. We have always treated Ukrainians with respect. They are a fraternal people with whom we have inextricable historical ties. It is no coincidence that several million of them have found refuge in Russia.
So, yes, so that's the Russian member of the Security Council there speaking, and he began his speech, maybe I'll put that up on our show page, the full speech, explaining why that Zelensky should not have been at the UN Security Council. He spent about 15 minutes explaining all the minutiae of why is this guy here? He's got no right to be here. And also he was talking about other speakers at the UN Security Council, like Italy, saying, well, Italy's not got a border with Ukraine. What are they doing here? And of course, this is all just shenanigans prepared by the Czech or the Slovaks. I think it's the Czech Republic that's chairing the UN Security Council at the moment, Martin. So how do these two conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine, how do they relate to each other?
Well, they're related in a military sense because the Russian aerospace forces are embedded with the Syrian Arab Army, which is, you know, facing off with the Israelis in the Golan Heights. one of the things that the Russians may decide to do is to stop the Israelis bombing Syria. They've been basically being allowed them to fly planes into Syria. They could shoot them down, but they don't do that. That's one of the things they may decide to do. And of course, the actual war in the Ukraine and the Middle East, they're all linked. This is one of the reasons why the Russians intervened in Syria, because they could see chaos from Syria spreading towards them into the Caucasus, Chechnya and so on. We've got the two sides for World War II are all lined up. We all know who's on what side, and they're already fighting. It's World War III. Sorry, I don't know. Why did I say World War II? World War III. It's already started. It's already going on. And all of it's linked. Of course, one of the things the Russians may decide to do is supply the Houthis with some of their high-tech weaponry so that they can sink British and US ships outright with no mess. And that's one of the things they may do if we fire our Storm Shadow missiles at them. That's one of the things they may decide to do is not to fire back directly at Britain, but sink a British ship in the Red Sea. So it'll be their allies that will do it.
Today, Netanyahu's been speaking. I mean, I'm sure it'll be all over the news bulletins at the UN Security Council tonight, irritatingly. They only seem to take any notice of what he's got to say, as he seems to be the sort of guru for the Western press. He says Israel's fighting a war on seven fronts. Well, why don't they make peace? Why doesn't he make peace? I think, you know, most commentators are correct when they point out that actually Netanyahu's fighting for his own political survival, Martin. It's nothing to do with all the people that are dying in the process.
Well, he is, but also Israel has become a rogue state. I mean, they are a danger to everybody, including us. I mean, do we want to die so that the Israelis can massacre the Lebanese and the Palestinians?
US, France, and allies called for a 21-day ceasefire this week. Netanyahu said, well, maybe, but he's told by people like Ben Gavir, who I ought to point out, isn't it the Kahan party that he's part of? Up until 2022, that political party, and its various parts of it were proscribed in the United States as a terrorist organization. And he's now telling Netanyahu, no, you're not going to have a ceasefire.
They were proscribed in Israel as a terrorist organization. And of course, this 21-day ceasefire is another, there's no way that there's going to be a 21-day ceasefire. It's just a way of people like Keir Starmer.
Isn't it quite good to get the Americans to agree to that?
No, it's all just
a game, is it? Surely calling for a ceasefire at the UN is quite important.
No, it's a game.
It's not just a game.
It is a game. There's no possibility. What Hezbollah have said is we're not calling a ceasefire until you negotiate with Hamas about a proper ceasefire in Gaza. They started fighting the Israelis when the Israelis went into Gaza and started killing all the civilians. Hezbollah then said, well, we're joining in now and we'll stop. We're absolutely happy to stop. The Houthis have said the same thing. If there's a ceasefire and you put humanitarian supplies into Gaza, we will stop. But we're not stopping while that's going on. While you're still killing those Palestinian children, I'm afraid we're going to come kill your soldiers, and we're not stopping. And we're not going to, if you want a ceasefire, you've got to stop doing that. The key to this is a ceasefire in Gaza. And there was a ceasefire deal done, which Hamas agreed to, and then Netanyahu vetoed. Now, they've got to go back to that original deal and carry on through on it, and then there will be peace. But the Netanyahu and the Israeli population in general do not want to do that.
Is this going to affect the US elections?
I want to answer that, but also come back to your previous question about how do these two conflicts relate, Ukraine and Gaza, and clearly to me it shows the hypocrisy that the rule of law, you know, applies so selectively that it's basically a weapon when the Western forces want to use it as such. They only apply it when it suits them. There's so many similarities, but yet there's so many more civilian casualties in Gaza. Russia has clearly done a better job of actually targeting combatants. It's at least six times more. I think it would be much more, actually, but I just saw, civilian deaths.
In a much shorter time scale.
So it's the hypocrisy, and it's serving the interests. You know, there's 2 trillion reasons why the Gaza war is going to continue. It's the natural gas that's there. that has already been sold to Infosys, that Priti Patel's wife has massive shares in.
Husband?
Yeah, UK BP. Controversial. Sorry.
Priti Patel
Rishi
married
Sunak's
to a woman.
Wife.
Oh, right.
To the US election, I mean, all the stuff is bringing up what's been really on my mind as well, that the left, supposed traditional left-wing parties in both the UK and the United States, to my eyes now, are far more in line with what you really think is a right-wing party than the traditional right-wing parties.
No, you're right.
Right.
Butch Ware is the deputy leader of the Greens, running mate for Jill Stein, who's the presidential candidate for the Greens in the United States, mm-hmm. as a third party. And he popped up amazingly yesterday. I was listening on the PM program on the BBC.
I've been privy to the results of the latest Yakin Institute. Yakin, one of the kind of largest private Muslim they do a lot of religious education, but also political education, activism, and so forth. This is Imam Omar Suleiman's group. That they've got polling that indicates, that will drop this week, that says that as of right now, 53% of Muslim Americans are voting third party.
53 are voting for you. Look, Butch, let's take your figures. I don't want to get into an argument. We've only got a couple of minutes.
Hold on, wait, one second. Yeah, go ahead.
Please. What I want to say is, aren't you going to let Donald Trump win? I think you probably would rather Kamala Harris won than Donald Trump. I'm right about that.
Oh, no,
surely.
I couldn't disagree more. Donald Trump has not genocided the population of Gaza. The Blue Party, Team Blue, the Democrats that pose as friends and benefactors, as Malcolm put it, referring to liberals, the liberals pose as friends and benefactors, but they are wolves. They bare their teeth. You think they're smiling at you, but you are on the menu. The conservatives, on the other hand, they're the fox. The liberal is the fox. They bare their teeth. You think they're smiling, but you're on the menu. The conservative is the wolf. They bare their teeth, and you know their intent. To be perfectly honest, right now, there is one party that is speeding towards World War III with nuclear potential for escalation throughout not just the Middle East, but also in Ukraine. The Blue Party has been sending...
The Democrats.
The Democrats have been sending cops in riot gear to my campus, in Democratic states, in Democratic cities. They've got cop cities. Everyone wants to fearmonger about Trump and fascism. Fascism is already here under Team Blue, and this is a fully corporate party.
This is really interesting. So sorry to interrupt, Butch, but this is really, really interesting because you are actually saying that you don't draw a distinction.
There's one part I need to add to this before, because it changes the calculus of the way that you'd ask the question. The reality is that the Democrats have already lost this election. Okay. So in Michigan, Georgia, and Pennsylvania, in the 2020 election, Joe Biden received 65% of the Muslim vote in those swing states. Okay. And he was polling at 12% in January 2024. They are just north of that now at 15%. They cannot win any of the swing states that are needed for them to have an electoral college victory. And if I knew that when I joined the campaign a month ago, they certainly knew that through internal polling in January 2024 when this happened. So everything that they're saying now is a big show. They've already lost the election. And the question is, how much power will a third party actually consolidate in this election?
So that is the running mate for Jill Stein for the Greens in the US presidential election, Butch Ware, the third party, nothing to do with the Democrats or Republicans. But Martin, interesting, really interesting, isn't it? He's basically saying they've already lost because a lot of the swing states are going to be the Muslim. You know, we always hear about the US Jewish vote, but what about the US Muslim vote? It sounds like it could be absolutely crucial this time.
Well, of course, the system in the US isn't really a democratic system.
Neither is it here. Yeah, they're not democratic, but you have a voting system, you have an electoral college system or whatever, and you have to just go with it. But what he's saying here is the practical result of the US election, whether or not you agree with the particular system they use, which you obviously don't, is going to be a Trump win because Biden doesn't stand a chance because of what's happened particularly with Gaza.
Yeah, and of course those Muslims aren't going to vote for Trump. they're going to vote for Jill Stein. So Trump will win in the Electoral College, but he won't win the popular vote. He will then have total power to press the button
on
anything.
And wasn't it interesting?
But he won't have 50% of the vote.
The way that Evan Davis there said, well, obviously, you know, because you're a Green, you're going to be pro Kamala Harris. No. And he's talking about the attacks on the campuses and things like that. So it's a fascinating little insight. And it's a sort of example that, you know, you do not hear these voices on Radio 4 very often, so it's nice to hear that, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I was terrified of the first Trump presidency. It felt like a white knuckled roller coaster ride the whole time. But I've looked more at the policy, more at what he's done, more at what Joe Biden's done, more at what Kamala is promising and what they've done. And I've pulled off the lenses of the propaganda. They really have. No, I'm not. I don't like Donald Trump. I can see all the things that they you can criticize them for, but they're so exaggerated. And I love that comment about the wolf and the fox. Trump bears his teeth. You can see when he's angry and emotional, and Biden pretends to be this, you know, very conservative, very sensible old man. But you actually look at his policies. He's vicious. And Kamala is so ingrained into that. She's more of a puppet. Interestingly, I found out someone did some research. She's a prosecutor who's never actually prosecuted a case. She got to her career by dating a former mayor of San Francisco. She's just a puppet. You know, she's reading that AI generated speech. Anyway, the broader point is that the left is now more vicious and Trump, believe it or not, I'm certain at this moment, I'm not saying he's great by any stretch, but he is the lesser of the two evils between the Democrats and the Republicans right now. And there's many reasons why. I mean, but broadly, the Democrats are calling for more censorship. Kamala is saying we need more censorship. Trump and RFK are saying we need to get this censorship out. The Democrats have used lawfare. This is shocking. Against every one of their opponents, they, in every single state, they sued the Green Party and RFK and Cornel West to get them off the ballot. I mean, if you heard news report that Putin was using lawfare against all of his political opponents to take them off the ballots in Russia, wouldn't you just go, oh my God, how fascist is that? They've gone really too far. This is literally what the Democrats have been doing in every state, and it worked. RFK had to withdraw. And RFK is another good example. He's a lifelong Democrat. I mean, he's one of the royalty of the Democrats for his family, the Kennedys. He has switched and joined the Republican. He's running in a unity ticket with Donald Trump on the Republicans. And he said, look, it's not me, it's you. I haven't changed. The Democratic Party is unrecognizable. And there's so many commentators right now saying that, even guys like Jimmy Dore, you know, who's pretty leftist, and Glenn Greenwald as well. These guys, you know, they're all saying, like, look, the Democrats are, they're now the more pro-censorship, pro-war state, pro-corporate state. And I'm sorry, if you don't like what I'm saying, just look at the policies, do a little digging. A lot of the smears you've heard about Trump, I'm not saying he's great, but a lot of the smears are actually, they don't stack up to scrutiny. And if you look at the policies that RFK and Trump are putting on the table, getting rid of censorship, tackling big pharma and the food industry, they're going to declare a national emergency and tackle the pesticides, the additives, the poisonous additives. I think that's actually really great. So,
Think Trump might just ditch RFK as soon as he gets in?
No, he seems to really respect them. I mean, you know, Trump. There's plenty of times where you know he's not talking straight. But I get the real sense that when he just body language, he reveres RFK, and RFK has successfully sued Donald Trump before, and I kind of like that they are able to work together. I mean, I think he generally reveres him. He's bringing in a lot of the policies that RFK was putting on his platform, including the getting rid of the censorship, and RFK is talking about having quite a a good role where he wants a roving portfolio where he can tackle corruption in the CIA, in the food industry, and so these are really good things. I think while they're not perfect, they don't have a good policy on Israel. They do have a policy to get out of Ukraine, which I think is fantastic. You bring up Iran, that's a worry, but that was in response to, you know, allegations that Iran might have been involved in an assassination on Trump. So
Rubbish.
No, you don't
think so? Of course not, no. Oh, it's a CIA. This guy who was there last week was a CIA guy.
Quite possibly. You know, but anyway, I don't know if Trump believes that or not.
Well, the Israelis will be feeding that to him. People like Jared Kushner will be saying, hey, look, we've got some intel from Mossad. The Iranians were behind that. You know, that sort of
nonsense.
It could
be true. But is it worth pointing out, though, I think that that's what Trump's bluster, again, showing his teeth, but he was actually the one that didn't start any new military incursions, the first U.S. president in 30 years not to begin any new military incursions, and he says he'll get out of Ukraine immediately, and I think that's really important.
Martin,
save a lot of lives there.
Well, as I said earlier, the Muslim vote in the swing states isn't going to go to Trump; it's going to go to Jill Stein. Now, that in a first past the post system,
what are you pointing
gives,
out gives, there is that
Trump
means Trump will get in, yeah.
Yeah. It gives Trump the victory. But you don't have to vote for Trump. You can vote for Jill Stein, and you're still going to get Trump, but you also keep your conscience clear because you haven't voted for him, and you can criticise him openly, and you can say, we're not going to go to war for Israel. And, of course, that's exactly what he's intending to do. He's going to go to war. He's going to get out of the Ukraine, and he's going to go to war with Iran, and he's going to go to war with China. But if you voted for him, you've got to accept that.
No, he's not going to war with China.
Well, the Pentagon may stop him.
Mm.
Yeah, but
why do you say he would?
Well, because don't forget that we were talking about COVID earlier. Peter Navarro, who was his trade advisor when he was president, was very keen on we've got to smash the Chinese economy right now because they're getting too big.
Well,
for their
I
boots.
Don't think so, Martin. I think you're characterizing Trump as somehow complicit with COVID or something.
Trump didn't know anything about it because presidents don't run the United States, as Putin well knows. Other people and the people in charge are not in charge.
He is talking about bringing in a different group of people, and he's already done that by bringing in RFK and Tulsi Gabbard to inform. The one thing he did, I mean, he has never admitted fault. It's not in his personality, but he's admitted fault. He said, I promised to drain the swamp last time, and I failed. This was quite shocking to me that he was showing some contrition. And he said, look, I didn't know what I was doing. Again, an amazing admission of contrition there. And he said, I've no experience in politics, and I was surprised I won, and I just brought in people I didn't really know, and now I know the game, I know the people that I think I can trust. And so he's brought in RFK and Tulsi Gabbard and others to inform him, and who should he bring in? And I think that's great, because I actually have a lot of respect for those two. And so we'll see, but so far so good. It's a great start.
It might be why there's been two assassination attempts against him so far.
Oh, it could definitely be.
And maybe there'll be more.
There may be more.
Yeah, there may be more. Anyway, we're going to finish this week. We're going to finish this week. Dave can breathe a sigh of relief, with, an actual clip from last week, which is the New Zealanders speaking at the United Nations. Well, they were the only, country in the Five Eyes or NATO, if you put them as a massive block, or the, European Union.
Not in NATO yet. We're looking at it as a big block.
Okay, we could just talk about the Five Eyes, but there's a massive block that voted against a ceasefire in Gaza, and also some of those countries abstained. But the New Zealanders were the only ones to actually vote for the ceasefire. So let's hand it to her right now.
Order, please. Order, please. I give the floor to New Zealand.
Mr. President, New Zealand supported this resolution after careful consideration. We did so because we support a two-state solution and because we support international law. The Israel-Palestinian conflict has gone on for far too long. The suffering it has led to on both sides is immense. Its broader destabilizing impact on the region is profound. The effects are felt as far away as New Zealand. The only way to end the conflict is the two-state solution. Both sides need to return to negotiations to achieve this. This resolution, though not perfect, sets the international community's expectations that both parties must move towards a negotiated settlement. We hope the passage of this resolution will provide impetus to the parties to re-engage in negotiations. The 12-month timeframe set out in the resolution for Israeli withdrawal from the occupied Palestinian territory is frankly unrealistic. A two-state solution needs to be the product of negotiations. Aspirations need to be tempered by realism, given the complexities to be addressed. However, in the next 12 months, we expect Israel to take meaningful steps towards compliance with international law, particularly through the withdrawal from the occupied Palestinian territory. We would also expect the Palestinian Authority to take meaningful steps to assume political and security control of the occupied territory. We are strong supporters of the International Court of Justice. The ICJ's advisory opinion aligns with New Zealand's long-standing view that Israel's conduct in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. However, we are disappointed that, in some cases, the resolution goes beyond what was envisaged in the advisory opinion. Although the resolution does not impose obligations on New Zealand beyond any already existing under international law, New Zealand stands ready to implement any measures adopted by the UN Security Council. New Zealand will continue to impose travel bans against extremist settlers and others involved in violations of international humanitarian law as we deem appropriate. Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, she's quite good. Nice to hear from her.
I thank New Zealand.
I thank New Zealand too. Matt, I think she did quite a good job, didn't she?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how nice it is to hear some sobriety. It still doesn't quite go far enough, but I'm very grateful that New Zealand has come out and said that Israel should abide by the rulings of the ICJ and withdraw from those occupied territories, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Yeah. It's great to hear a Western nation finally coming out and saying that, and about time. It still doesn't go far enough. I mean, the ruling also suggests that we should be really using sanctions and stopping supplying any financial support for any of this. So New Zealand should really be looking at cutting trade at the minute with Israel, and so should all the West. Really, that's what it needs. We can't just be asking nicely. She said all the right things, but it's still just asking politely for Israel to abide. Like, they're not going to abide by it. That doesn't matter how nicely.
But anyway,
we
she
ask
was
them.
Part of the 2/3 majority of the world that voted for the ceasefire that condemned Israel as a racist apartheid state. I mean, it was a pretty pretty forceful resolution.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
Martin, actually, the New Zealanders did discover some naughty Israelis stealing passports in the Christchurch earthquake, didn't they, and arrest them and
That's
deport
right.
them?
There's some reason
they're prepared
for
to stand up to the Mossad.
Israelis,
I mean, it's interesting because the Five Eyes they're part of. The Israelis are supposed to be quietly. I remember Alex Thompson telling us on this show that the Israelis are quietly part of all that. So they don't seem to be able to quite leverage the New Zealanders the way they can the Aussies, the Canadians, and the Brits.
No, they don't. And it's what's significant about this is you've got a right-wing government in New Zealand, but it shows that the general tenor of thinking in New Zealand is to the left, even though you've got a right-wing government. Mm. Yeah.
Yep. Because Is it really left and right?
The other thing, of course, is that New Zealand in the 1980s, we've discussed this on previous shows, when the Labour government was bringing in all this ridiculous Thatcherite policies.
Anti-Israeli is not left anymore, is it? Not at all.
No, it's everywhere. You know, even in the United States, where they've got all that mainstream media propaganda, it's still 64% that say we should stop. They should stop sending weapons to Israel.
That's right. Well, I mean, that's because it's great. You know, that's because that's what ought to happen, and right thinking people think that.
It's the main thing, isn't it?
Anybody who's got any sense is saying that's what we've got to do.
But it's great because it shows a crack in the darkness, that the light's coming in through. Even though they're doing their darndest to control social media, they just can't. It's just these. Too many cracks, people sharing information. We're seeing this. That was the first time we've seen a genocide live streamed, isn't it? Yeah. And it's shocking. I mean, you think back to Iraq and we got the collateral murder footage, which shocked people. But now we're just seeing this stuff all the time. And
it's largely due to Telegram. Anyway, look, Matt, can we wind up by just sharing with listeners your contact details and whatever? If you people want to follow you, where do they find you?
Yeah, that's great.
The question.
Yes, on the usual social media platforms. As What's flawed that? As they are, I still think it's a,
run by these four that, billionaires. These four billionaires that are trying to have their fantasies destroy the planet.
That's right. Although I wouldn't label Musk as the worst offender. I think Zuckerberg is worse. But as again, it's a lesser evil situation. But anyway, you can find me on these wonderful, perfect platforms. Matt O'Brannon, which is MattOBrannain. And,
That's Twitter, basically.
Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Those are the ones I'm more on, and a little bit of TikTok as well. Sometimes breakthrough on TikTok, and believe it or not, there's some actually amazing stuff on TikTok at times.
It is. It's one of the best. All right. Yeah. Anyway, thanks ever so much. Time to sign off now. Thanks you very much.
Thanks all.
Particularly to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to Kiwi activist here in Bristol, Matt O'Brannon, also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download the MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and you can follow Tony Gosling Censored whilst it's still there on Telegram. By the way, this week there was an announcement that Telegram seems to have come to some sort of agreement with the French government, where they're now saying that if people are selling illegal goods or committing crimes on Telegram, that their terms of service has been altered so that they can share people's IP addresses with the authorities. So that's the change that apparently has been made in Telegram after Pavel Durov was arrested by the French after being tricked into thinking he was going for a meal with Macron and then arrested. And I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperbacks about deals between the Allies and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, at Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. That costs £15. Also, my secret government anthology From Cromwell to the Princess Diana Assassination. The Siege of Heaven Reader. That is, they're both on eBay. You can find the Siege of Heaven ebook with all my articles, including this year's, at www.bilderberg.org. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and at Sunday breakfast at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. We've been streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol on that talkradio.org.uk stream, at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know, and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down. Beckoning countenance, thoughts whispered sweetly. You girls make no
تحدى الخوف والخطر عدوك يا وطن اندحر الخوف والخطر يرحلون ونبقى والأرض لنا ستبقى ها نحن اليوم أقوى أقوى في كل المناحي يرحلون ونبقى والأرض لنا ستبقى ها نحن اليوم أقوى أقوى في كل المناحي بيتي هنا أرضي هنا بحر السهل النهر لنا وكيف بوجه النار أسالم سأقاوم الحق سلاحي وأقاوم أنا فوق جراحي سأقاوم أنا لن أستسلم لن أرضخ وعليك بلادي لأساوم بيتي هنا أرضي هنا بحر السهل النهر لنا وكيف بوجه النار أسالم سأقاوم
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do.
We are not afraid today. We are.